Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the Silmarillion Film Project. This is session number 8 of season 7. I'm Corey Olson, the Tolkien professor, and I am joined tonight, as usual, by Marie Prosser, one of our head writers. Nick couldn't make it today, and neither Nick nor Dave could make it tonight. So we've invited a special guest, Ilana Mushin, who's been joining our writers' room here in the last couple years, and she and I were just hanging out down. Well, not quite where you live, but not much closer to where you live than I normally am, which is down in Osmoot in Sydney. It was a wonderful film contingent there. We had Ilana and Philip Menzies, our composer, and I all able to hang out together, and we had a bunch of film discussion, including, of course, the world premiere of the Finrod Sauron song battle, which Phil has composed. So that was a lot of fun. My favorite thing, I know, Ilana, I know, I remember, I heard you talking about this with Phil too. I love, so like that, you know, Finrod and Sauron are sort of singing at the same time. And the end of their lines, when they sing their lines at the same time, they sound like they're almost going to resolve, right? They're like, but then they don't. They like then go like a half tone apart, right, and clash instead. It's really, really cool, like how it like the way that he has sort of set up the way those two lines together totally sound like they are like about to achieve resolution and harmony, and then they just refuse to. And that's, I think it's really, really fun.
Available on YouTube. Now.
Hmm. Yeah.
It's available on YouTube now.
It's so available on YouTube now. Yep. YouTube. Yep. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. So. Anyway. So that's. So you can go to Philip Menzies' YouTube channel and you can hear it on YouTube, and we'll have Phil on later, and I'm sure we'll talk about it at a later session here. So anyway, that's it was so much fun to be able to hang out together, and you know, Ilana and I were just telling Marie we were solving like problems for season 12 already, you know, in anticipation. We got things sorted out. This evening we're going to finish our final discussion of the sort of storylines of season 7 in preparation for the plot outline, right? The detailed episode outline, but the season outline, right? As we decide how to frame it into 13 episodes. We already have, you know, as usual, when we get to this stage, it's kind of begun to resolve itself a little bit, but there are definitely some decisions we're going to need to make and figure out. One of the things to me that I'm going to be really interested to see how we balance is the Sauron Galadriel element of the plot line.
Right. It's one thing to discuss and be like, all these things will happen. It's like, and where do they fit with everything else? So that's what next time will be about.
Yep. Yep. So we will see, but that's what's coming up next. But tonight, so the last things, as I mentioned, the last things we didn't resolve are the dwarves and the villains. So that's what we're going to resolve tonight. Now just a quick announcements before we go. We have a bunch of moots that are coming up here soon. Just got back from Osmoot down in Australia, which was just such a delightful time. You know, Ilana, I barely even want to talk about it too much, just for this, like, for fear of the envy that you know, we will create by talking about how awesome Osmoot was, because it was really, really wonderful. Just a marvelous time down there in Sydney. Looking forward already to
as Marie discovered, the time zone's not that bad.
It's not that bad. It's a little bit late in the evening, but if you ever attend this live,
instead of morning, yeah,
exactly. It's evening instead of morning. Yeah. So it's not ideally convenient. And there were certainly some evenings where the activities didn't end until like 3-4 in the morning Eastern time. But, you know, much of the meat of the, you know, moot was happening at a quite reasonable hour. In any case, we're already looking forward to Osmoot 2025, which is going to be in Melbourne, Australia. It has been decided. So, That should be really cool. But anyway, our next regional moot is going to be Sunshine Moot, and that's in just a couple weeks, down in Orlando, Florida, on February 17th. And then we've got Tex Moot down in Houston in April. We've got SoCal Moot out in Carlsbad, California, near San Diego, in the beginning of May. UK Moot out in York, England, on April 27th. So we've got a bunch of things coming up still. Another Canadian moot that we're looking at later in May. That should be the registration for that should be posted soon. We've got already some confirmations for other fall moots that have been trickling in, including New England Moot on the 19th of October. So we got all kinds of things going on. We even have potentially another European moot later in the year. We're looking at possibly a moot in Germany timed with Oktoberfest, which is going to be a pretty fun combination too. In any case, lots of fun opportunities to get together. Osmoot was a really fun, you know, as all of the moots are. But Osmoot was a particularly fun reminder of why we do moots, how much fun it is to get together, to spend that time together, to connect with other people who are into the same stuff that you're into. It's just a really, really fun opportunity. So really enjoying the moot cycle looking forward to our eventful spring here. Okay, let us glance at the map. So, glancing at the map, one of the questions that I immediately see of relevance to our discussion this evening is the proximity of, thinking about the dwarves, right, and their, sort of business in the land of Caranthir before, right? So we've had the dwarves involved up in that sort of northeastern segment of the Arid Luin here. And that's also going to be in the area where the humans cross over and come in. So I'm reminded that we may want to kind of remember that, you know, what possible implications there might be of all of these hordes of dwarves of humans crossing over the mountains up there in territory which had otherwise really just kind of been dwarf terrain, essentially. It doesn't seem like something that we must absolutely, build a story around, but something that we might not want to forget about either.
Right. It's something that is relevant to the dwarves' perception of what is going on. Because it's not like they've just heard that there are humans who have come into Beleriand. They would have seen them cross over and had their own thoughts and feelings about that as they went through their territory.
Right, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's kind of, one can imagine a fun kind of, revisitation of the humans, like with the green elves, except like now the shoe's on the other foot. Right. Thinking both of the green elves and the dwarves back in season 3, and then thinking about the green elves and the humans in season five. So kind of now, things turning again, and this time it's the humans and the dwarves. And the dwarves, of course, their response wouldn't be of the same sort as the green elves' response was. They would have the same issues. But I think there might be issues, nevertheless. But anyway, let's broaden this a bit and go straight to thinking about the dwarves. Let's not start in the middle. Let's start at the top with the dwarves. So let's start with Azaghal. He's sort of our central dwarf character, central dwarf in the sense that he is the central named dwarf in the Nirnaeth. He is going to be the centerpiece of the action here. Now, Marie, remind me what we already said about Azaghal, because we had already made a couple decisions in anticipation of this before, right?
Right. So we have Durin the Deathless in Khazad Dûm, which just means that whoever's in Khazad Dûm is named Durin most of the time.
Right.
More or less. And so for Silmfilm, we decided that we would have Azaghal the Deathless in Belagost and Lauren the Deathless in Nograd, mm-hmm. in the sense that the king of those places is always going to be named that.
Right.
Even if he wasn't born with that name and if it's a different guy.
Right.
So that was so that we could use the name Azaghal before we got to the season where Azaghal is actually the king.
Right. We didn't have to worry about extending his life indefinitely.
Right. Yeah. Right. So that was a choice that was made. We've revealed that choice in Nograd in season 5. When Eol went to Nograd because a new king had just ascended, but it still he still had the same name. So Eol knew that dwarves are mortal and that they were passing the name along. He was in on that.
Right, but the dwarves were not keen to share that information with the elves.
Right, and that was part of the let's present to the elves that we stick around and not let them in on the fact that we're mortal. Let's keep that a secret for a bit. Whether or not the elves have figured that out by now is kind of an open question. Like, we showed that clearly with Eol, it was no secret, but he knew a lot of dwarf secrets that the other elves didn't know. So how well-versed in dwarf is your average elf?
Right.
And yeah, so we have that as a still fairly open question that would have to get resolved this season, because if we're going to start having an actual alliance, then there'd have to be fewer secrets.
Right.
But the question then with Azaghal is the actual dwarf who's on the throne right now. Mm-hmm. How long has he been around? Is he a young dwarf? Is he an old dwarf? That's something we get to choose. We haven't boxed ourselves into a corner yet on that.
Yeah.
He should definitely be the same king who was in charge during the Dagr Bragollach.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he has not come to the throne just the second.
Right.
But
yeah, it would be starting absolutely from scratch would be a little weird and unnecessary, I think.
The only reason to do that would be if it's the new young guy making different choices and that's why he's doing things differently than everyone before, but that doesn't seem like the story we're going to want to tell.
Yeah, and we don't have any motivation to do
later,
that.
Later, isn't
that?
There's not that many years.
Yeah, it's a 17-year gap between the battles.
Yeah,
and for dwarves, that's nothing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there's no like external force compelling us towards that sort of decision. Like the way that, you know, the decisions we were forced to make for Tel'kar, right? Because we couldn't have Tel'kar stick around for the whole, you know, 500 years
and
or whatever.
We had wanted Tel'kar to make the Dragonhelm. Since that's
and
one
we
of
needed
the
dragon helm
made.
Earlier,
and you
yeah.
couldn't have the dragon helm until there was a dragon. So we had to time Tel'kar's death with the appearance of Glaurung.
Right.
So we introduced Tel'kar a little early and let Tel'kar live a fairly long time, and just didn't specify exactly how old anybody was. But we were pushing it with Tel'kar to encompass the season 3 storyline as well as the appearance of Glaurung at the end of season 4.
Right. Right.
But we did all that. So Tel'kar.
Azaghal could still be a young dwarf king, even if he was young in the Dagr Bragollach. He could still be young in the Nirnaeth.
Yeah. Sure. That's what I'm saying. We can choose his age. I was suggesting that he's been around at least that long, in the sense that it's only 17 years. Mm-hmm. But how much longer he was here before that, we get to decide. And the one action he takes in the book is that he gifts the dragon helm to Maedhros, who gives it to Fingon, who gives it to Hador, and that's where that gets eventually to Turin, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the piece of that transition that we showed in Silmfilm was Hador getting it from the elves.
Yes.
So Fingon giving it to Hador was what was on screen.
Right.
Where did Fingon get it from? Who knows? We showed Tel'kar making it, and we showed Fingon gifting it. Mm-hmm. So the story of how the Dragonhelm got to Fingon was not part of the story we were telling in Thunder.
So that's something we could raise. Like, it could come up. I mean, obviously, right. since the whole dwarf plotline is trending in a Glaurung direction anyway,
I was gonna say,
we might as well raise it, right?
There's a time to come back to that, and now is that time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
if Azaghal gifted it to Maedhros, who gifted it to Fingon, and that all happened before Hador mm-hmm. even moved to Dor Lomond, now in a season when we're talking about Hador's heir bringing Dor Lomond to war, the dwarves joining this battle, Glaurin appearing on the field, there's opportunity to yeah. flash back to the meaning of the Dragonhelm.
Can I tell you the one thing that makes me a little uncomfortable about this whole chain? It's the very end of it. It's Húrin opting not to wear it, like, which just seems ungrateful, right? Like, this awesome special helmet, which was gifted to Maedhros, which he gave to his friend, which he gave, and which Húrin's like, nah, I hate that helmet. Like, it messes up my hair. Like, I don't love that. I mean, yeah. it's hard.
It's supposed to be a little heavy and doesn't fit him.
But seriously, but, like, could you imagine looking the dwarf, like Azaghal in the face and be like, it's a little cumbersome, honestly. Like, I just, yeah. I'm not feeling it, you know? Come on. Like, it's so,
obviously,
especially.
The reason he has to not wear it to war is so it doesn't end up in Angband, because that's where Húrin ends up at the end of the war.
Right. Yeah. So I know. Like, I get that, but I'm just saying that it feels. Especially if we make any kind of a big deal about the provenance.
So
right?
the workaround, we would have to change the story, obviously. So
right.
We don't have to do that. But if we were to say we really want Húrin to wear the Dragonhelm for at least part of this battle, is we would need the guy who leaves and survives and takes the important item with him. Like, Isildur died on the road. How did anyone ever find out what happened to him?
Right.
Well,
we need
there
like
was a
what was the guy's
Otar, right?
Otar. Yeah, I know. I remember his name. I can't remember his title. What was he? Esquire?
The word something? I don't know.
Something.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yes.
The point is that guy.
That
so you
guy.
Need that guy to leave the battlefield and be ordered. Like, no, you in the
but
special
no,
need
no
to go
one,
home
no
and
one
live.
Came back. But no one came back.
Right,
came
exactly.
Back.
We'd have to.
Well,
we'd have to be like, except that dude who carried the Dragonhelm. Right.
I was very specifically saying this would be a complete change of everything else. But if you want to put the Dragonhelm on him in the battle, that's how you.
That also creates a bit of like that. That would mean that news would get back to Dor Lomond that Húrin was captured alive. Potentially.
No, because this guy would have to leave before that.
He'd have to leave before that, yeah.
Okay.
That's
it would have to be like literally like an Isildur situation. Like, okay, we're headed to the Fens of Serac. Can you, you know, not come?
Can you, can you just run to Rivendell real quick and let everyone know that this is not going well for us?
Right, exactly. So, I mean, it's in the end, I think the cost is too high for that. Mm-hmm. That is the cost of... I mean, having one dude survive isn't the end of the world, but to compromise in some way the end of the Men of Dor Lomond is a lot, right? But
it is.
to just push to the side the Dragonhelm in the context of this dwarf and dragon plot is also a lot to ask. I mean, it's, again, how awkward is that conversation going to be? Like, when they, you know, if they meet or whatever. I mean, now... They don't have to be, right? Azaghal's coming from the other side, but anyway, yeah.
So the other thing we can do is, if we want it to be important and symbolic, Húrin's riding off to war. He's leaving behind an 8-year-old son, who's obviously way too young to go to battle.
Right.
He can give it to his son before the battle and be like, this is yours and this is your heritage and everything. And, you know, you're the man of the house now, little guy. You know, whatever farewell we're going to do between Húrin and Turin, which should be kind of horrible, we could include the Dragonhelm in that and have it specifically be left behind so that Turin would have something.
Right.
If we wanted to do it that way.
Yeah.
Still sounds like a weird choice, but at least it wouldn't be like, I'm just going to leave it sitting on the shelf.
Well, yeah, it is better than that. I mean, it is better than, yeah, I'm just, oh yeah, sorry, I'm going to wear my second best helmet today for absolutely no good, again, for like fashion purposes, right, yeah, or whatever.
Yeah. Well, you know, he needs to have a matching helmet with Huor, and Huor doesn't have a dragon helm, so right. He wouldn't want to be the odd guy out.
It's all, yeah. Right.
It's all up to the fashion, you know?
Outfit yeah. matching day. Yeah, no, yeah. Exactly.
I don't know.
Right. He has to go twinsies with Huor in the battle. Yeah, yeah. No, I get that. Yeah.
Nick is going to be so mad at me.
Yeah. Steve, I know Huron doesn't wear helmets. I'm just saying that's a crappy reason not to wear the dragon helm into battle against the dragon. Like, that's, I mean, make an exception, dude. Like, it's a horrible policy. Like, do it. Like, that needs an explanation, which, you know, we're not given. And again, like, he wants foes to see his face. Like, okay, that's dumb. Like, if Huron said that to me, I would say, Huron, that's dumb. Man up and put on your freaking helmet, right? Okay, like, seriously.
Right. The actor will be fine with this choice of his character to not want to wear a helmet.
The choice, yeah. But exactly.
It's not a particularly wise choice when riding out into battle.
Yeah. And again, my main problem with it is that it's... I'm thinking of costs, right? And the cost of having, it would be one thing if we just like tried to let everybody forget the dragon helm existed, right? Mm. Which of course we could only hold off on so long, because with Turin it would come back and somebody would still be saying, why on earth wasn't Huron wearing this, right?
Right.
There's no good reason. So even if we just tried to kind of downplay it and not have him wear it and hope nobody worries about it too much, as opposed
it's gonna
to
feel
making,
like a plot hole.
It's
so,
going to feel like a plot hole.
Like,
yes.
we forgot about it.
Exactly.
And then,
especially,
yeah.
But again, we can't even do that with the dwarves. This is why this is relevant to the dwarf discussion, right? Because
yes.
With the dwarves and the ultimate, again, the focus is all on Glaurung, right? I mean, it's all Glaurung oriented ultimately with the dwarf plot. And so the dragon helm with Glaurung on it, right, which they gave to Maedhros, with whom they're, I mean, it's too relevant, I think, not to bring it up. It would just be weird.
I do think we need to mention it.
Yeah.
So the question now is Azaghal the same dwarf who gifted that helm to Maedhros, who gave it to Fingon, who gave it to Hador? Or
it
was that
have
his
to be because it was a while
or was
back.
It his dad? It could be
yeah.
his dad.
Could be his dad.
It depends how old we want Azaghal to be.
Yeah.
I don't think we want Azaghal to be nearing the end of his.
I don't want him ancient
lifespan.
No. Yeah.
I don't think we want him to be an ancient dwarf, but
unless. Okay, here's the one argument for ancient Azaghal that I can think of: Theoden parallel. That's my argument for ancient Azaghal. Especially with the whole I felled the black serpent thing. But even apart from that nifty little parallel, if we want his, and I don't mean Theoden's story fully in the, like, you
no.
know, the healing and redemption arc deal. I just mean if we wanted to have his, because the one thing we know, right, the one framing fact of whatever decisions we make about Azaghal is that he's going to die, right? But he's going to die, and in his death, he is going to strike.
Stab a dragon,
right.
And if his blade had been just a little longer, it would have been a fatal wound, yeah.
Right,
like,
exactly. So he's going to almost kill Glaurung, which is kind of a big deal, and even is a big deal for that day. As I mean, it's hard to say the day of the Nurnoriad would be worse, but it could have been worse, right? And it might have been worse had Glaurung not been driven
from
the
field.
When
yeah.
he was. And I think that will be easy, he says casually, to arrange, like, to show that Glaurung's, I'm imagining Glaurung's onset being completely devastating, but diverted. Like, that could be one of those moments that we were talking about before where it looks like things might go well, like where it looks
right.
like it might actually work, Right.
Right.
One of the most hopeful things I would think to happen on the field that entire day is going to be the driving off of the near fatal wounding of Glaurung. Right.
Yeah.
So Azaghal's death is a big deal and very heroic. Right. So when I'm thinking of Azaghal and his age, that's kind of my starting point. Right. The end is the starting point. And so it's like, what kind of noble, heroic, you know, death do we want him to die? It could be Theoden-esque, right? The like, you know, in the fullness of my last act, you know, as king at the end of my long reign, when nobody thought I had it in me, right, is to, you know, rise to the occasion and almost slay Glaurung. Like, that could work. I mean, you know, to give him that sort of a Theoden-esque end could be kind of cool. Sorry, go ahead, Alana. Oh, I think you're muted there. Sorry.
To what extent have we shown dwarves being warlike yet in film? Because they've mostly been trading. And we haven't seen them on the battlefield, really.
Not since yet. Season 3.
Season 3, yeah. Briefly. But three. Even that was not... They weren't really involved in the major thing.
So to what extent is Azaghal a warrior king? Theoden was a warrior king. So, that kind of made sense for his story. But this is something kind of new for the dwarves, isn't it? To come out in battle like this.
Yes. To come out in battle with the elves against a common enemy, this would be fairly new. The general implication is that there have been private dwarf wars happening that the elves know nothing about, and the only reason we have any hint of this is because the dwarves are really good at making weapons, and the trade from Belagoth,
they have a lot of practice,
has been mostly weapons.
Yeah.
So the question would be, why would Belagoth have become a kingdom that specializes in weapons of war if they're not a warlike people themselves?
Yeah,
it would be very difficult to see how being the supplier of war was separate from being a warrior.
Mm-hmm. So we need to have that in the story somewhere that we like, because we're not showing these internecine dwarf wars.
We are not. The only
we'll probably have them talking about it.
The only other hint we've had is the existence of the petty dwarves. They are exiled dwarves. Yeah. So that shows something about the interdwarf conflict in the history. But
even that is chiefly in some kind of judicial context rather than military.
Yeah. And we're given to understand that, these are people who committed some crime that has caused them to be exiled, not necessarily people who were warring enemies.
Right.
So, we would have to see a little bit more of dwarf culture to get enough of that background to realize that they have a warrior culture at all.
I mean, it's a thing that, it's the kind of thing that I would think our viewers are sufficiently prepared to believe that we could just say it and ask them to take it on faith, right? I mean, if the elves were to discover in their conversations with the dwarves, like, the elves might make the same assumption, Ilana, that you were just describing, right? Like, oh, these dwarves are just traitors, right? They don't really fight in wars. Nobody's ever really seen them fight. And so when they approach, so somebody's going to be like, well, somebody ought to approach the dwarves for, to make them allies and see if they'll fight with us against Morgoth in the big attack. And somebody would be like, oh, they don't fight, right? They're not fighters. And they're like, well, why don't we ask them? So they ask them. And then, the dwarves are like, what you don't know is, like, we're totally, anyway, like, they would be all offended or whatever that, like, they thought they weren't warriors. And I think if we were to approach it, vaguely that way, our viewers, I think, would be ready to believe, that the dwarves are warriors. And so it wouldn't take much convincing, even if we haven't established it ourselves on screen, I think. So I think we have the ability to do that. But it does open up the question that we're not really prepared to give a good answer to, which is, where have they been fighting exactly?
And who have they been fighting? The implication that there's multiple houses of dwarves and they're not all very nice comes from Tolkien.
Yeah.
The one group of dwarves that are the honorable, noble dwarves is the House of Durin.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got these two houses.
Yeah.
And then there's the other dwarves. Right. And the other dwarves can come into question mark of, have they been at war with each other forever? Knowing right. dwarves, possibly. Like, there's their ability to hold grudges is pretty long term. So if there is a disagreement, it is going to last.
Right. Right.
But we don't know. We would have to make it up. So you're right. We're not prepared for that.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm prepared to make stuff up, but but I don't know that we have time.
But to commit.
I mean, because honestly, the whole idea of, like, internecine dwarf wars is sufficiently unpleasant that we don't just want to drop that and leave it, right? I mean, I feel like if we raised that, we'd kind of have to explain it, right? There'd have to be a story, at least to some extent, right? In order to, because I mean, they're going to have questions. Like the elves would have questions. I mean, could you imagine?
The elves would have questions.
You're telling me y'all are just like kinslayers and okay with that? Like, it's kind of a big deal over here, right? So yeah. I mean, I don't think that's something that we can just casually drop.
Right. So we did that with humans. We did it with humans. We're like,
right.
By the way, capital punishment is a thing for humans. Just
right.
So you know, elves, like, FYI, that's how things
right.
work
but
here.
But we kind of, like, made it
did
a whole
that.
Subplot of an episode.
Right. To establish that because yeah. elves were going to find it weird.
Right.
So, yeah, we'd have to do the, oh, wow, dwarves are not who we thought they were
yeah.
from the elven perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe this can be an internal discussion amongst the dwarves about getting involved in the
yes.
war. Like, they can see what's happening. They can see the elves are mobilizing and so on. And maybe they make a positive decision to join the war
yeah.
at this point for their reasons, rather than the elves coming and asking them to join.
Right. So what we had said to fit it into the other storylines is mm-hmm. that once Azaghal and the people of Belagost see that the Feanorians are all in, and this giant horde of humans who have just come over the mountains is also part of the force, they do the math and say, look, if these guys go to war and lose, it's going to go badly for us.
Mm-hmm.
Because once they're gone, what's to stop Angband
yeah.
from
yeah.
being on our doorstep? So better to fight now with all these allies.
Yeah.
Then wait until they're on our doorstep and we have no allies. Is
because,
pretty
I mean,
much the
supplying. Sorry.
Right, because you can supply all the weapons you want, but if the guys lose,
yeah.
So
yeah.
then,
I guess I'm saying we don't need to go into their own civil wars and so on because they've been supplying
case.
Weapons. They like making weapons. They're dwarves, you know. Like there's mm-hmm. a war going on. They've been making weapons. Like I don't think we need to explain why they're so good at making weapons and so good at innovating, because they like
yeah.
doing that sort of stuff.
And honestly, over explaining, not a dwarf tendency, right? So you know, the conversation you'd think would go much more, would be much more likely to go something like, hey, we'd like to fight with you, but can you fight? Yeah, we can. Try us and see. We can totally fight, right? Ask no questions and I'll tell you no lies about whom we fight and where we learned. Right. But like, why would they say more than they're dwarves? Why would they say more than that? Why
right.
would they talk about, you know, their own internal struggles if they had them?
Exactly. So an illusion at most, but probably
yeah.
very little. And
even possibly an elf character speculating, like, where did they
yeah.
learn to fight? I wonder whom they were fighting that they learned to fight. But
right.
So,
and that could go into the treachery fear conversation in
mm-hmm.
the West, everyone's pretty confident that if you're joining the battle, you probably are 100% allies with everybody else who has joined the battle. Like, there's very
right.
little doubt on the Western front that any of the elves are going to, like, turn traitor and betray them.
Right.
Not no doubt, because there's the whole Spell of Bottomless Dread thing where there's
right.
some plants and what if,
yep.
right?
Yeah.
What if a spy? But
yeah.
on the east, you've got the Feanorians, the brand new humans that nobody knows, and the dwarves who have never joined the elves before.
Treachery
all of these
central
groups.
On the eastern front.
Right. Like, opportunities to betray each other and be afraid of betraying each other prevalent.
gang of hugely unreliable characters.
Right. Yeah. So we don't need to have the dwarves give their history of who they fought. Mm-hmm. All we need to do is have someone speculate that dwarves probably fight and kill each other and don't even blink about it. And are you really trusting these people with your back?
Yep.
And whether that's a human character or an elf character speaking, that's that doubt that we want to be sown in.
No, that's great. I like that a lot. So all of this would seem to me to argue for a young Ezekiel then. So the story that immediately comes to my mind, right, is that we have a young Ezekiel. Doesn't have to be like super young.
No.
He could have been around at the Dagor Bragoach, right? He was alive.
He's 100%. He was 100% king at the Dagor Bragoach.
Yeah.
Again, it's only been 17 years. I don't want to redo.
I'm not saying we have an infant king or a child king of the dwarves. No. My point is, he's still young enough in his reign that he's going to pivot and go in a new direction. Like this is not like a king who's already been reigning for 200 years now deciding that he's going to go in a different direction.
Right. Yeah. So to give age examples, 250 is about the limit for a dwarf.
Right.
That's time to die now. Yeah. Thorin was approaching 200 at the Battle of Five Armies.
Yeah.
Not quite there, but upper end. Gimli is around 139 during the time of the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
So when you're saying a young dwarf, do you mean like a Gimli age dwarf? He's not like young, but
I think Gimli at max, even potentially a little bit younger. I would even be fine if he had just come to the throne, possibly even since the Dagor Bragoach. He was alive and remembers the Dagor Bragoach, but he doesn't even necessarily have to be reigning. Like basically what I'm saying is the easiest way to explain a total shift in policy among the dwarves is new king.
The new king, right, which is why I brought up his age, because I thought that might be relevant. All right, so then my last data point for comparison is Cili at the Battle of Five Armies is 77.
Right.
And Fili and Cili are consistently referred to as young dwarves by Thorin, who's almost 200. So to him, it is a significant gap. But they are.
Gimli was like 50? Right. At the time of that's why he was left out of the when he talks about in the Quest of Erebor, wasn't it? When he mentions
it's 80 years difference.
It's 80 years in between.
Yeah. So he was 140, he's 60
in the 50s. Yeah. Between 50 and 60. I mean, I don't remember where it is. I think it must be in the Quest of Erebor. Where he mentions that he
was
left
too
behind by his dad because he was too young. He was only, so that means the border's right there, right? Between Gimli, who was almost 60, and Fili and Cili, who are in their 70s, right?
Mm-hmm. Almost 80, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so you're thinking a dwarf around 100 years old.
Or, I mean, 80. Why not?
Okay.
Make him 80, young, right?
80 to 100, but that bracket of range.
Yeah.
Who is considered young and new by his people, but it's not a kid. He's clearly a grown dwarf who's been king for a while now.
Right.
But not forever.
Yeah, this is not somebody that the other dwarves are going to be patting on the head and not taking seriously.
He's an established king, but he's young. He could have a much longer rule ahead of him had he not marched off to battle. So it'll be that kind of tragedy, not the you were old anyway, and your last heroic move almost killed a dragon.
Right. And I'm thinking maybe he is like this prodigy, right? Maybe I'm wanting to make his death extra tragic, right? And also I'm thinking about the way that the rest of the dwarves forget about the battle and do immediate funeral procession for him. Like they take his death really, really seriously. Right.
They do.
And so if he is young, new to the throne, and everybody is really excited about him, that would solve a couple things, right? It would both solve how he's able to mobilize them, to do this thing that they've never done before. Right. I mean, it's a big ask for any of the kings to say, okay, I mean, he can order it, but again, like, he's gotta have the pull to convince everybody to be in on this new policy, right? And mm-hmm. if he's young, it seems that the best way to do that is, you know, he's extremely charismatic. He's, you know, you can have dwarves talking about how, like, you know, Azaghal is going to be the greatest king they've ever had. Of course, they'd have to admit that they die of old age if they said that. So maybe they don't say that to elves, but still, they would among themselves.
Internally.
Yeah, internally, they could be talking about how, and then, and you know, they can say some, like, portentous things about how, you know, he's going to accomplish things that no dwarf ever has. And he kind of will, right? But unfortunately, it ends.
Yeah.
And then, again, this, which then, like, the grief of the dwarves, it's not just that their king has died, but, like, for what they have lost. And also, if he's that young, he could still have a kid already. I mean, like, he could have a very young child. But it would mean the dwarves of Belagost would be virtually kingless for some time.
They're out of the story now.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. The why don't they do this again?
Mm-hmm.
Their king was struck down in his prime.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact that, like, the faction of dwarves who would not be excited to go again would have a really strong argument, right? With the, you know, like, they would take it as a sign, right? That was like, well, that didn't pan out, so let's not do that again. Even apart from the fact that they no longer have that.
So one consequence of this decision is that this King Azaghal did not gift the Dragon Helm to anybody. He's too young.
Right. He's too young.
Right. So it would have been his father who did all that.
Yep. Yep.
Which means if he is personally going to meet with Mythros, he's not the same dwarf who met with Mythros before. So as far as the cat being out of the bag among the elves,
That if he is noticeably young, there's not going to be any concealing that. Like, there's not going to be any concealing the fact this is not the same dude, especially since Mythos has met the other dude.
That's the... So if we're mm-hmm. wondering how we handle elves knowing, and how do we bring up the gift of the Dragon Helm, that could be... Now, again, that's not the only way you can give a gift. If you're a king, you can send the gift. Mm-hmm. So it's possible Mythros never met the other guy. He certainly didn't go to Belagost, because they wouldn't have invited an elf in to Belagost who's not ale. So we can get around it if we wanted to preserve that secret.
Well, I feel like we've been squirreling around four different topics and resolving none of them, but let's come back to that for a second. I think the idea that they're trying to keep this from the elves is fun. Like, that I love kind of how that kind of came out naturally, right? And
Norn figured out that elves weren't mortal and then was like, oh, snap, you guys, let's not tell them.
Don't let on that we, especially since there were no other precedents. Like, we didn't have humans yet, right? So. It made them look like just the weaker, you know, of the two.
Which is why it was a secret to hide. Yeah.
Yeah. I love how that all happened. And Norn was just like, I'm going to retire now and just go do another thing because that's what I feel like doing. It's not like I'm about to die of old age at all. Right. I love that. So I love the concept, but I feel like the idea of them carrying that off indefinitely just feels really implausible.
Right. The part where we've shown one elf in on it means that the audience is probably going to find the game stale at this point.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
How long do you keep up a pretense when the audience knows that you've been doing it all along?
Right.
Other characters already know about it. Like, who is this a secret from? And then the elves who are in the dark just look dumb for not knowing.
Exactly. It starts making them look stupid.
Well, also because there's humans now. I mean, the elves at the time of Norn, there were no humans. So
It was easier to pull off.
Now about mortality.
Yeah. This doesn't mean the dwarves have to, like, actually come out of the closet about it and talk about it, but they But yeah, I don't think we need to pretend like the elves haven't figured it out, basically. Okay. Though it's possible the elves could, like, be like, it's not polite to mention it in front of the dwarves because they seem to not like to talk about it, right? I mean, we can still kind of make that, you know, kind of discreetly, you know, understood among them that they're not going to make a big deal of it, right?
Right. Diplomatically, no one acknowledges whether dwarves are mortal or not.
Yeah. Let's not, okay. Yeah. In which case, it really doesn't need to be a big deal. Okay. And we don't have to have anybody, any of the elves, that is, like, puzzled or surprised or...
Right. That's like more that. What I wanted to avoid was a shocking reveal that dwarves are mortal at this point in the story where it's not shocking nor a reveal.
No. Right. Exactly. Okay. No, I agree. So it's I think we can kind of discreetly, Well, we don't have Finrod for this kind of philosophical speculation anymore, but...
It's very sad.
Some kind of... I mean, I don't know that we will possibly have time for this, but the question of the deathlessness of Azaghal, right? He's not immortal in the elvish sense, but that the dwarves have certain strange beliefs concerning themselves is something that absolutely could somehow come up, potentially. I mean, if they call him Azaghal the Deathless, there could be some confusion.
We were going to allow Curufin to be the
Rude.
Diplomat representing the Feanor and the dwarves.
He's a very convenient diplomat in that way. I love Caranthira's diplomat.
No, Curufin.
Oh, sorry, Curufin. Sorry.
Yeah, Caranthira's been fired from Dwarf Diplomat. He's no longer wanted for that role. And he's going to work with the new humans who have come over.
Perfect.
And that will go swimmingly for everyone.
Yes.
Yeah, but Curufin is available, and we need Curufin to not catch on to what Aldor the Accursed is up to. So we need Curufin to just not meet Aldor. If they're never in a room together, the fact that Curufin didn't suss him out is not that surprising.
So we occupy Curufin with Azaghal. And honestly, they'd have a lot to talk about, right? I mean, Curufin...
He's not quite the same kind of philosopher as Finrod is.
No, but he
But he is a thinker.
And has a lot in common with them. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, as far as, you know, craftsmanship is concerned, right? You know, Curufin's big on that, right? He's like, I used to have this dagger. It was awesome. You know, you have history with that. Never mind. Let's not talk about the dagger. So there's stuff that they could discuss.
So if we need to have any kind of pondering on the nature of the dwarves, we can use Curufin for some pondering, I think.
Yep. Okay. All right. So we're not going to carry that on. So here's us making decisions. If Azaghal's father gave the dragon helm, in some way, I think that actually sets it up even better for him to bring it up. Right.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about the dragon, right? And, you know, Azaghal would totally be saying, well, fortunately, you know, you don't have to, Mythros, you don't have to worry about the dragon because, you know, my father gifted you the perfect anti-dragon weapon. And so, you know, obviously we have this dragon problem sorted, don't we? Right. And then Mythros is like, about that.
Right?
Yeah. There's a funny story about that helm. That would seem very natural that he would raise
and
it.
And that can bring up the first appearance of Glaurung, because Fingon was the one who faced Glaurung. So if Mythros is like, yes, you're right, it was such a wonderful gift, I gave it to the perfect person, the one who actually fought the dragon the first time he came out. No, not my brother Caligorm. The other guy.
Right. The first time he came out, not the second time he came out.
Yeah. No. Caligorm was with Fingon for that.
Oh, right. Yeah. The
in our version.
Yeah, in our version. That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
But
actually,
I'd forgotten
about that. But yeah, that's right.
So that's the problem when you change things. You have to remember you changed
it. Yes, you have to remember you changed it. Yeah.
But so that'll bring out that part of the story again. And then someone can be like, oh, yes, but Fingon, you have this dragon helm. Be like, about that.
Right.
I gave it to a guy. And then, oh, Hurin, so we hear you inherited the dragon helm. It's like, oh, about that. I gave it to my son before I marched out to war. Like, so everyone who's like, oh, but you've got it. It's like, no, I gave it away. So I'm not sure we wanted the dragon helm of Dor Lumen to be a joke. Like, this is a running gag.
It's starting to sound like a running gag. I mean, I don't know that we necessarily want it for comedy, but...
But I do feel like that's what we're left with if we're not going to use it in the war. It can't be a serious thing. It has to be a, oh, hey, so what happened with that is...
Unfortunately, we've already played this card too many times, but... a good reason for Hurin to not wear it into battle is...
Did he have a dream?
Not a dream. I wouldn't go as far as that. But I get some kind of sense that, like, not just like, I want to give my kid something, how about this clunky helmet, right? Instead, having him be like, you know, some sort of foreboding, you know, that this helmet belongs to Turin with his son and not with him, right? Mm-hmm. But again, we played the foreboding card already quite a bit in our defense. So does Tolkien play it quite a bit. So we have opportunities. Other problem, though, with the leaving
Could
with
we...
Turin thing. So, no, go ahead. Anna. Someone want to say something there?
I was just wondering how much we need to play the... Am I coming through?
Yeah, you are.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Just how long, do we need to play it so that it's an offense to have passed it on, as opposed to, like, this is actually not a bad thing? Like, makes sense to give it to Fingon, you know, that's...
Yeah.
And,
no, I don't
and
think
then
it has
it
to be
sense
an offense,
to Fingon
necessarily.
To give it to from the dwarf's perspective, I don't... Not, so that mitigates the comedy, I think. If it's not a big deal, actually, that this gets passed on from the dwarves' perspective, then it's less comedic, and it's just, this is where it's ended up.
Right. And if we think about, you know, gift giving in and the recycling, like the status of re-gifting in, like, Beowulf, for instance, right, it's a marvelous use of it. It would not be hard to explain to Azaghal that the dragon helm actually symbolically ties together all of the all of the allies. Like, it has been used in turn to cement the allegiances of everyone who's coming to the field, practically, right? And that's a great accomplishment by it. Just still makes it awkward to leave home on the shelf. That's the only problem. But anyway, so coming back to Turin. Here's the other issue. Again, I want to make sure we're counting the cost before we are too rash about this. The moment when the dragon helm is re-given to him, right? When Beleg brings it to him, right? Needs to be a huge deal. Now, this can be, like, the gift from his father can be used to sort of set that up. But, why doesn't... If it's set up as, like, this is your whatever, like, your birthright, the memory of your father and stuff, we'd need a reason for him not to have been wearing it all along, right?
Well, he flees Doriath, but he flees Doriath for murder. So it's not like he went home and packed his bags first and got his stuff out of the treasury. He just took off with whatever he had on him. And so he could be even regret leaving that item behind, and that could be why Beleg chose to bring it, thinking, surely this will get Turin's
attention. As a symbol
attention.
Of his pardon and his acceptance, and Right. It's almost like a regifting in that moment.
Right. So we can still make that work.
Would we have him, that is Turin, wearing the dragon helm with Beleg on the marches before the incident? And again, if not, why not?
How old is Turin when the incident happens? He's young still.
He's still young.
So if he's only 8 during the war, he's obviously too young to put the helmet on. And then in Doriath, he doesn't have a lot of opportunity for fighting.
But he's on the marches.
When
he's out on the marches, it's... Yeah.
Yeah, so the question is, would he... Because him putting it on is a big deal, I agree. If he's just using it for regular guard duty when he's a teenager, it feels like it's not as momentous when he puts it on the first time.
Exactly.
To solve that, when he comes to Doriath
for him,
Thingol would have to be like, oh, this is a treasure of your household. We will put it in a place of honor in my treasury. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we get to see the Silmaril somewhere. And like, and here's the dragon helm. And
right next to the Silmaril, yeah.
Yeah, you know, place of honor. Which means Turin has no access to it. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we will put this in the place of honor to honor your house and like keep your treasure for you. And it's like, thanks, that was my dad's. And okay. You know, 8-year-old kid doesn't maybe feel the honor so much.
Right. Or so he never... I don't remember the dates, but I got to think that Turin, when he goes off with Beleg to the marches, has got to be what, 16, 17?
Teenager. Yeah. But not. Yeah, it was. Yeah, maybe a little older, but he's definitely
if
not 20.
We were to hint that, that Thingol, or at least Beleg, had a sort of plan for, like, the rite of passage when he will, you know, put on his father's helm and take up his... as I would imagine, they would have conversations. I mean, here's us planning, you know, well in advance, but... anyway, okay, never mind. We have to pursue this. It could work. The point is it could work.
We could make it work. But the more times you repeat something on screen, the more diluted it becomes. So it is true that we have to be very careful not to dilute gifting Turin this helm. That's a big deal. But if what it's supposed to symbolize is his father, having his father hand it to him on screen is probably the best way to convince the audience that this has anything to do with his father. Mm-hmm. Like telling them next season, oh, that was your dad's. It's like, what? He never wore it, so.
Right, exactly. We don't associate it with him. Yeah.
Right, so I kind of feel like the scene would add to that sense rather than subtract.
And it does avoid the main thing I'm worried about, which is making the dragon helm just look like a mathem that no one's particularly interested in. Right. I mean, it needs to be a big deal.
Especially since the dwarves are going to show up with an army all wearing helmets that aren't necessarily the exact dragon helm, but in that style, this is very much a dwarf helmet just made for different proportioned heads. Mm-hmm. I guess. I don't know what the dwarf proportions are.
Right. Exactly.
Our dwarves are fairly stocky, so I figured.
Yep. Yeah. No, I think that works. And so I'm trying to imagine, like, Hurin's response, if anyone asks him, like, where is the dragon? Why are you not wearing the dragon helm of Dor Loman? Right?
Oh, and you can say it's in Dor Loman.
Well, his answer could be even something along the lines of, like, you know, I have... like left it in the hands of its not like rightful wielder, but something along those lines. Right. Like mm-hmm. it is, you know, or even like, you know, the dragon helm shall yet be heard from, you know, some, he can say some things which point, he doesn't have to have an actual foreboding, you know, like you are the one who should wear this and not me necessarily, but, okay. All right. I think that this can work and can justify him not. It's certainly less awkward than having to invent a dragon helm runner who escapes the battle.
That's the only way I could think of to get around it ended up in Angband, which is where we don't want it for the Turin story.
Yeah. Right. And we don't want it. It's no help taking it to Gondolin.
Well, the other thing is if it ended up in Angband, the only person who's going to get out of Angband and meet Turin is Gwyndor.
That would be too weird. And by the way, I pilfered the dragon helm and I brought it under my arm, you know, all the way from Angband. Hi, random crazy guy I've met in the woods. I'm random elf. Oh, and by the way, I have your ancestral helmet here in my pocket. Like, it's weird. Yeah.
It is. It's weird. I'm trying to think, what are all of the options?
Yep.
And they're
yep.
all fairly bad.
They're all fairly bad. I agree.
So I'm okay with the story the way it is. And us
the least
just
bad option.
Coming
yes.
up with a reason Hearn doesn't wear it in the battle.
Yeah.
Other than, I don't like helmets.
Yeah, that's my sticking point. Is just that it's one thing when we learn that that is the fact, but he doesn't, like, he doesn't have to say it. Like, Tolkien doesn't include it in the narrative, right? And I think if it did come to including it in the narrative, Tolkien also would have thought it sounded weird. Like, for Hordin just to be like, oh, no, I don't like hats. I don't do hats. That's why I'm not wearing the dragon helm of Dor Loman to fight the dragon. Like seriously, can anyone yeah. even utter that sentence and have it make sense? Right? Or have it be convincing? Like, I don't know. It just doesn't. Okay, but anyway, all right. I think that's our best bet.
Okay. All right. Another dwarf question I have, if we're good mm-hmm. with Azaghal and yep. Belagost,
think
is
so.
Nograd obviously does not join this yes. war at all. Do we care? Is anyone going to ask them to? Do they purposely refuse? Are they just not there? I mean, do we have a preference on what happens with Nograd?
On the one hand, it's hard to imagine it doesn't come up, right? I mean, the Feanorians know about both of the dwarf houses. So when they get, even if Azaghal volunteering is like a windfall to them that they didn't anticipate mm-hmm. and didn't seek, it's oh, well, really? The other one's interested too? Like,
yeah,
somebody's
going to invite your neighbors to join us in this barbecue.
Yeah, someone's got to have that, got to ask that question, I think. And so here is where to me, the obvious answer, given on what we were already talking about with Azaghal, is unlike Azaghal, the king of Nograd is an old king stuck in his ways. And it's a contrast, right? The people of Nograd are like, of course we're not coming out to fight in the battle. Like, we never do that. Like, that would be dumb. And Azaghal is the one with the new vision, right? He's the forward, the young, charismatic, forward-thinking dwarf king who is like, no, we must, this is not time for the old ways anymore. Like, we must do this new thing because our survival depends on it and you don't see it.
We showed the ascension of the king of Nograd when Eil followed Arathel back to Gondolin. That's why he was coming home from Nograd early that time.
Right.
So we have a year locked in on when that was.
And
luckily,
that was a
it was
while
a while ago.
Yeah.
So it was back in season 5. It was probably about 70 years before the battle. I'd have to
and
look up
exactly.
And he
needn't have been young when he took the throne.
Right. He was an adult taking the throne.
Yeah.
So he's at least Gimli aged.
He could totally, he could be 200 without a problem.
And we could make him Thorin aged if we wanted mm-hmm. to. Just, totally. I was just letting you know that we did have a locked in date of the date of his ascension.
Yeah, that's right. No, I had forgotten that. So, that's good. But yeah, no, I think we can make him, I know it's sort of simplistic, but we don't have time to develop whole new multifaceted characters, right? If we have the simple thing, because just this is going to be a very, very minor plot line. There's no way in which we can give the King of Nograd much screen time in this season, right? So
no.
If we have even the relatively simple, the King of Nograd is the voice of tradition and what we've always done, which is support them. I'm not saying we turn away from them. I'm not saying we be jerks, but we don't put ourselves into danger. We've never done that before, except that one time, and that was kind of weird, and it didn't totally work out. So, anyway, because of that, we're not doing it again. Anyway, so he's like, voice of the status quo, and Azaghal is the one who you know, with his fire and charisma has brought the people of Belagos to this different place where now they're willing to do this thing that they've never done before. But the people of Novgorod are still not, because the old king is still running the old plays.
Right. Which is fine. I just want to make sure we knew that and didn't like forget about them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's...
We don't even necessarily need him on screen. I mean, this could be reported back.
Yeah, exactly.
As well, depending on how we plot things.
Yeah, no, I think that would be more than enough for this. I mean, because we would just need, like, the one conversation with, you know, what about Novgorod? And Azaghal could say, yeah, I asked. They said no.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, too, is enough to establish this Azaghal is different, right? And, again, to build up this idea, I mean, it would be awesome to build up this big sort of what could have been, right? Had young Azaghal survived, what might have happened, right? How might things have been different? In Doriath, say, if young Azaghal had survived.
For instance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And it certainly gives us
an
opportunity.
We can do some interesting things with that power vacuum, can't we?
Yes, we certainly could.
If the heir to Belagos is the kid.
Yep. Yeah. We could have some kind of CD Lord Protector, you know, in Belagos. And yeah, no, absolutely. And lots of opportunity to, and like, you know, people with ill will, like general ill will to like regret of, you know, the losses and the death, and therefore some kind of vague ill will towards elves as well. I mean, one could imagine a faction saying, essentially starting from the foundation of, well, that alliance didn't work out and was obviously a bad idea. Let's not go anywhere near that again, which becomes a, you know, develops into a kind of xenophobia or whatever. Anyway, I'm just saying, like, sowing the seed for the discord with the dwarves that's going to come later, this, it makes sense as a stepping stone to that. So yeah, yeah. I think that that could be, I think that could work really well. I'm liking the young Azaghal plot. I think this is the way to go. One thing, Maria, I'm feeling guilty about is I know Nick couldn't make it tonight and he had lots of dwarf ideas. Do you know if we're wrecking any of those?
Right. So what I'm familiar with is, I know you and he are in agreement that dwarves should make siege engines for the war, but we will entirely discuss the plans for the war at some point and get into that. The other thing that he has been building up is he wanted a couple of everyman dwarf characters that we could follow through this season, and they would have been at the siege around the dragon last season. So when the dragon leaves Caranthir's stronghold, they witnessed the dragon. So they have personally seen the dragon.
Right.
And he was going to bring them back through various scenes of the dwarves deciding to join the battle and then taking part in it. And so they'd be, you know, on the field taking Azaghal's body off the field at that time, too.
Right.
So they were just going to be kind of our point of view dwarf characters whenever we needed to see what the dwarves are experiencing in all of this, apart from Azaghal, because he's the king. So he can't be everywhere and he can't be on the ground. And yeah.
Right.
So, and so... we've introduced them. They've been on screen last season, but they were just, you know, there. So
right.
I know Nick wants to use them now.
So we would have, what do we need? We don't need somebody who's just like right there with Azaghal, because we already have Azaghal, right?
Right.
So we have Azaghal as our one character, and he covers the whole strategy, decision-making, cooperation with the elves thing. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Connection with Curufin as well. So we want a dwarf engineer right, in the Dwarf Engineering Corps, if we're going to be building siege equipment, that'll be separate from Azaghal, and that'll be a different way in which dwarves are going to be interacting with the elves and the rest of them, right?
Right. And so this pair of dwarves could be on siege building equipment duty or drafted for time to go join the war duty, whatever. Like, they could be where we need them to be, I think was the goal.
Could the dwarves who are, like, separate from the dwarf army, like the engineering corps, could they get pulled into the betrayal? Uldor's betrayal? And again, I'm thinking towards future bad blood, right? If there are survivors who are betrayed and who, especially if they could be contrived to blame the elves for what happened, right?
Right. Well, I mean, it would be hard not to blame Caranthir.
Yeah.
Kind of at fault.
At the least, he's an idiot. Right. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but even if he looks like more than an idiot, right?
Right. That's, yeah. Did he allow himself to be used? Was he on their side? How much was he part of all this? The dwarves might not know the answer to that and might assume the worst.
Yeah, if they see the humans as, like, just the tools of Caranthir.
Right. And then the humans do a bad thing. Yeah. Did Caranthir tell them to? Like,
right. Because, of course,
how involved is he? How culpable?
It seems logical, because one of the things that, like, if you're humans who are betraying the army and, like, destroying the siege, like, sabotaging the siege equipment is a thing you would do, right, to help ensure that they don't win.
Which would make the dwarves particularly angry, destroying their
army. Yeah, especially if, like, murdering many of the dwarves is part of that project, right?
Even worse.
Yeah, so, like,
this
surviving dwarves.
This is a Swanship's Kinslaying situation. Not only did you kill all the people, you burned the ships!
You burned the ships, exactly. It's like
you killed a bunch of dwarves and took out the siege of
the twofer right in one spot, right? Yeah, you're offending everybody.
Right. So, yeah, I do see the potential for some bad blood there. And
that would be another reason to have a point of view and dwarf engineer character who could be then one of the survivors who goes back.
Or not a survivor.
But in any case, somebody needs to survive so that they can spread the story and help foment the bad blood that's going to come.
Right. Right. And there is a pair of them. So we probably only need one to survive.
There you go. You only ever need one to survive. So,
anyway. I don't know what Nick's plan was for the end of those two characters, but I do know he wanted to have that in place going into this season in particular.
No, that makes sense. I don't know that I would imagine a large, like, I could imagine the dwarves being, like, divided up to that extent, right? You know, the Azaghal, because Azaghal is going to be able to represent sort of the main dwarf body, right?
He's the king and the leader of the army.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And there are a lot of characters. I mean, Council of War is going to have a lot of people in it, right? So we don't need to populate it with multiple, dwarf leaders or spokespersons. Okay. But the engineering corps, that works and satisfies our desire for siege equipment and explains why it wasn't used. So,
We'll see. I mean, remember, we have to plan two wars. The war they thought they were going to fight, and then the war that they actually fight.
Right, right.
Siege equipment may take part in one or the other, or both.
Or both,
Depending on where we go with it.
Okay. All right. With that, are you ready to transition to villains?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So, villains. Now, where was I wanting to start? Okay.
We should start with the dragon, right?
Let's start with the dragon. We've been talking about the dragon.
Yeah.
We have him starting in his lair in Dorthonion.
Correct. Right?
Where he's been making baby dragons.
Yes.
Yes.
And turning the place into Tarnafuin.
Yes, exactly. Totally wrecking the joint in Dorthonion. Now, is he going to emerge from Dorthonion? So he's going to attack from that side?
So that's something we do need to discuss.
Yeah.
Because there's different opportunities of what to do, but mm-hmm. it very much depends on where this dragon is. So part of the reason why it feels like the right time to do this major offensive is yeah. that Morgoth has spread out his forces.
Right.
They've not just been all concentrated in Angband, they're now in Dorthonion and on the other side of the plane and all this. So you could do this pincher move and actually take out a lot of his guys.
Right. But it doesn't do to leave a live dragon out of your calculations.
Indeed. So yeah. if there's a live dragon in Dorthonion, suddenly this pincher move is like, and what are you going to do when you get to the middle and there's a dragon there?
Right.
So that's an open question. And then if the dragon's not there and he's recalled to Angband for some reason, then is he attacking from Angband? Or, like, we have to figure out where this dragon is and why.
Okay. So, I don't, for two reasons, I don't love the image of Glaurung emerging from Angband in this battle. Reason number one is that that's what happened in the last battle. And we don't want to just do the same exact thing again. The second thing is that the dominant, at least the battle in the West, right? The dominant kind of dynamic of the battle is the silent walls of Angband, which the good guys are attempting to storm, right? And through Gwyndor's attack, almost do, right?
Right.
Almost succeed in, you know, driving a wedge into through the gates themselves. We know that there will come the time when Angband is going to be emptied. So I'm not saying nobody ever emerges, but that doesn't happen until the very end, right? So this the way that Tolkien sets up the battle, and it's not like he describes what Morgoth's forces do in enormous, you know, tactical detail, right? But the major plot of the Nirnaeth is they're challenged to come forward and attack. They come forward and attack a vain attack at the walls, and then they get overwhelmed. Whereas the central dynamic, right, the central storyline, the central image of the Dagor Bragalach is the flood, right? The flood and assault outwards. And and again, it's the whole, story is this is Morgoth being attacked, not Morgoth launching an offensive like he did in the Dagor Bragalach. So for all of those reasons, I don't love the idea of Glaurung emerging from Angband. I think I'm Maedhros and Fingon, right? I'm Maedhros and Fingon. We got to say, all right, we know right now he's separated. The dragon is separated from them. If there is some way that we can contain him, right, keep him separated, then this gives us a kind of chance that we're not. So, like, this is part of their plan all along. I'm not saying I have a plan for that, but I would think that would be a sensible kind of plan to make, right?
Right. We know that in Tolkien's version of the story, Maedhros considers retaking Dorthonion to be an important first step in planning this assault.
Right.
So if there's a dragon in Dorthonion, you would think that would be even more important, not less important to your battle plan.
Right, exactly.
The problem being, of course, how do you take over Dorthonion when there's a dragon in it?
Right, right.
And so would we have to come up with some kind of plan of how to contain a dragon that they think is going to work and then clearly doesn't because the dragon does join the battle? Is there going to have to be an attack on Dorthonion earlier than the battle? Or are we going to do this as part of the battle? Like, we do have to think of the timing there, because that was supposed to be the action that gave away the union of Maedhros to Morgoth. Once they take Dorthonion, he's like, oh, okay, I see you guys are planning a thing.
Right. But
they have some experience with Glaurung now. So they, yes. you know, they've got his measure.
Right.
They can work with.
To a point.
Right. I mean, it went really yeah. poorly last time. Okay. They can't actually take Dorthonion, or else Glaurung has to go somewhere. And then where does he go? Right? There's no good place for him to go. If it's not Angband, where? Nowhere. Right?
Right.
So, I think that means he has to be in there.
So is this the origin of the saying? Don't leave a live dragon. Like,
this is where we learned that lesson, right? Yes.
Apparently.
Yeah. So... it's a rather awkward geographic region to try to contain a dragon in.
Yes, indeed. It's highlands, it's forest, very flammable forest, in fact.
And you, I mean, there isn't even, there isn't like there's some kind of convenient choke point that they can guard. Even assuming they could organize a Glaurung-proof barrier in a choke point, I don't
right.
see any obvious choke point in, because I mean, he's not even going to worry about mountain passes in the same way that other, you know, that like an army would
it's
be
it's not an
about.
Army exactly yeah. It's a single dragon, and the problem is the north of Dorthonion is extremely open to that plane.
Exactly.
And
exactly
Glaurung can go wherever he wants there.
Even if could all right. So, again, I see no evidence in the text that anybody had this very sensible conversation about Glaurung. Or,
well, Glaurung
I mean,
wasn't in Dorthonion.
Yeah, he wasn't in Dorthonion, I know.
So
but
that's the first reason they didn't talk about
it. No, I know that. But, I mean, as far as,
to,
like...
To talk about the dragon at all. Like, what was their plan?
What was the plan?
It's not like they didn't know Glaurung was going to
exactly.
be part of the war.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I mean. But
the
even now, given...
Ready.
The dwarves are ready. But yet it seems to me very unlikely that the elves would be, great, we have an anti-dragon measure now in an army of dwarves, right? Like, I don't...
Yeah.
Maybe, but I kind of doubt no. that. In fact, it feels to me like it would be a better story if the elves had their anti-Glaurung plan A, which fails...
And then the dwarves come into play.
Right. Unexpectedly, you catastrophically, the dwarves succeed in yep. driving him away and almost killing him. So then what's plan A? And given the circumstances, that is Glaurung more or less on his own in Dorthonion, I can only think of two possibilities. One, you try to hunt him down and kill him. Like you do a hunt of the dragon, which is no fun at all, or you do a scout the dragon and see if it's possible to, again, just bottle up the dragon somehow. Not geographically, because you can't bottle up all of Dorthonion, but if you theoretically
keep him occupied
or something, like if, say, somebody, right, goes in and discovers his lair. And is like, mm-hmm. you know what? We can't get... It's not about keeping him in Dorthonion as a whole. But, like, if we could keep him bottled up in there somehow, right? Maybe he's in some, I don't know, some... He can't fly, right? So maybe he's in some kind of canyon or, like, you know, I'm picturing something like Helm's Deep with the caverns, right? So there's, mm-hmm. like, a, you know, his main den, and then there's, like... So, basically, they see an opportunity to say, if we can just... somehow barricade this, we can at least give time and keep him here, keep him in here, right, while the battle's going on. Not saying that's easy or trivial to do, but again, it's better than trying to meet him on the open battlefield when he's fighting alongside thousands of orcs, right? So and possibly easier than let's send a merry band of hunters to slay him.
Yeah. So they know what dragons like now. That was pretty
true.
Clear after his interest in Caranthir's house. Slash.
Are you suggesting bribery?
I'm suggesting that you give him a hoard and let him sit on it.
Right.
Like, that's how you make a dragon leave you alone, right?
Right.
So that sounds a lot like paying tribute to the dragon, which maybe isn't a solution that we expect these guys to come up with. But at the same time, it sounds like your goal was a distraction. That's the only thing I can think of that'll distract a dragon.
Yeah. Either kill him, contain him, distract him. Yeah. I mean, there aren't so many options for how to keep him out of the battle. I don't know.
And they know that about dragons now.
So, right.
Yeah, they know that about Glaurung, that he's easily distracted if there's like nice shiny things in a big pile for him. So that could be a positive strategy that they have.
It's interesting. It's like Farmer Giles of Ham in reverse. We come with like backpacks full of treasure to the dragon lair and make
and
a deposit instead of a withdrawal.
Right. Here. We don't have any more. We promise. This is
right.
It.
Or you just you put a bunch of little hoards all over the place, and he's got to spend time collecting them. Right.
Well, when you're saying you can't bottle them up, you leave the little path of Reese's Pieces
right.
going into the place you want to bottle them up.
You know, yeah, like, yeah. It's imaginable that there could be some kind of natural, like even, I'm thinking of like luring him into a place and destroying a bridge out, you know, just to try to physically trap him. Not that it would, you would think it would work forever, but again, all you need is a little delay, right? A well-timed delay. So yes, if you lure him with treasure into a place that would be hard for him, you know, so you build your, like, you find your little dragon roach motel, right? That you lure him into, a really big box trap, right? That you trap the dragon in.
This is hilarious.
This is, yeah. Yeah. This is great.
I'm sorry.
I have an idea.
You can't seem to plan serious topic tonight. It's all like, the reason I don't have the dragon helm is, and so you build a box. No, a bigger box.
A bigger box, yeah. 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 I have an idea.
There has to be there's a discussion. Sorry.
No, go ahead. My idea wasn't a serious one. So you go ahead.
I'm trying.
Yeah.
I can imagine the discussion about the strategy to deal with the dragon in Dorthonion is we can't kill him. Like it doesn't. That doesn't look like. At least not until
it's sufficiently improbable that it's a bad plan.
Yeah. You know. And so containing the dragon is the best option.
Yes.
And so here's the plan for containing the dragon. I don't think it needs to be funny. I mean, it's
right.
Dragons and their hordes is a serious thing. I mean, you know,
we've
seen that already. So.
Yep.
You know, they're trying to use that against the dragon, and you know, it might almost work, you know.
Yeah.
So the Noldor have plenty of treasure. The Feanorians have a lot because they had the ships to come over from Valinor and were able to bring a lot with them. Mm-hmm. On the other side, Finrod brought the most. So Orodreth and Nargothrond is also sitting on a hoard, which obviously is relevant to Glaurung's interests. If anything that's from Nargothrond ends up in this bait trap, would that later explain why Glaurung targets Nargothrond? Like, would we be setting up the destruction of Nargothrond if we had some connection between what we're using here for treasure?
And in part, thinking about, like, a bridge and destroying a bridge, I'm sure you could tell I was also thinking about Nargothrond.
I figure that's what you had in mind there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. I mean, it would be kind of fun to sort of plant the Nargothrond idea in Glaurung's head here, right? Because he might not suspect. Like, he found Hellebore, right? And he's been roughing it in Dorthonion, but he would not have any reason to know that there was a very sizable hoard for the taking down, you know, south. So having him learn that might be kind of fun, if we can contrive that. It's also another way for Orodreth and or Gwyndor to kind of contribute without an army also.
This plot is very much going to turn into the who will bell the cat of, all right, so yeah. We need a guy to take a giant hoard of treasure into Dorthonion and leave it in a place that's really hard to get out of so that the dragon will come and get it. Are you supposed to survive this quest?
Okay.
Who's going to go into...
Who's the volunteer? Who would be most likely to do this?
This is a crazy move. So...
Who would be most likely to do this? Who? Hondir. I was thinking of Hondir. Like, a human is first answer. That a human would be crazy enough to volunteer.
Brethel has access to Dorthonion in a way that a lot of these other places don't.
And Brethel has a future with the dragon as well. Yeah. And we do have a spare named human whom we do need to die, but we don't have a particular way he needs to die or a moment in which he needs to die.
As part of this battle, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, before the end of the battle, he needs to die, but he doesn't have to die in the Fens of Serac, is what I'm saying. So, you know, he's not absolutely slated for that. So, so he doesn't have to survive. It would be completely nutso for Mythros and Fingon to be like, yeah, we'll send that dude in. He'll handle it, right? Like, that's... He can volunteer, but that they wouldn't even give him any help seems a little odd.
Very.
What about Rogrin? I know he's going to be in the main battle, but this could be it. This is earlier.
So is Glaurung. So, you know.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, he's a foolhardy kind of guy. Let me just rush this dragon. It's fine. Yeah, I could see Rogrin volunteering.
Also,
for that job.
Like post Angband, sufficiently like fatalist berserker attitude kind of deal that he mm-hmm. might volunteer for it. And being connected with Fingon as he's been since he got out of Angband, he would be acquainted with the men there. And so it wouldn't be as random as like a random Feanorian pairing up with a dude from Brethel, right?
Right.
I did not see this plot problem coming. I should have done, but I also left the live dragon out of my calculations, I have to admit.
Well, I knew we were going to have to handle Dorthonion differently than Tolkien did. Because we put a dragon in the middle of it.
Because we put a dragon in it, yeah.
I wasn't sure how we were going to handle it, but I knew we were going to have a off-the-book discussion here.
So, backing up several steps. This isn't something, obviously, that the elves can count on. But what are the odds that Glaurung is just not into it?
The battle, you mean?
Yeah. That... Morgoth says, hey, come in for the battle, and Glaurung's like, nah, I'm good. I don't want to. Like, that he just rebels. Initially.
They can't count on it is the problem.
They can't count on it, right. I mean, it doesn't reassure them at all.
Right. They can definitely say that,
but
during the last...
They can be planning. They can be planning this treasure hoard thing, and then it turns out they don't need to do much with it because Grarung doesn't go anywhere anyway.
But what they observed during the Dark of Bragalloch is that Grarung seemed to do his own thing. He did not seem to be following a battle plan on the enemy's side. However, he was completely devastating everywhere he went. So it didn't matter that he wasn't part of the battle plan. He was still the problem. The Dagger of Bragalloch would have gone much differently had there been no dragon.
Yes, for sure. And as I say, not only can they not count on it, they wouldn't even know that he was unwilling, right? They would have no reason even to suspect. I mean, again, Marie, you were just giving a reason for them possibly to suspect that he's operating as a free agent. But
right. They might think free agent, but they're not going to think doesn't care about battles.
Right.
He seemed
think
really
wild
into
card,
it the first
they wouldn't
time
think,
around.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. The most they're going to come up with is, well, who knows what this thing will do.
Yeah.
He's a wild card. But not the, it's fine, we'll just leave the life.
That's right. Yeah, I'm sure it won't do any. He'll probably stay home. Yeah, exactly. That would be rash. But
someone stupid could suggest it, but we would have to make sure that person is shot down very quickly in the council.
Yes. And, of course, the other problem that we have is that whoever is occupied with trying to solve the Glaurung problem can't be someone who's critical to the rest of the story. So, like,
that's
I don't
why
think
I
we've
came up with Hondir.
Yeah, we don't have a spare Feanorian, for instance. Really,
Amroth.
Well, okay, Amroth is always spare, but that would be super weird.
He does not seem well. Does he seem the type who would go on a fatalistic, might as well just die now mission?
That's true. Anyone interested in a suicidal mission? Oh, wait. Right, Amroth. Yeah, this has your name written all over it.
So, we can come up with people to be part of this if we need them to. They can survive. And get out. Like, just because we're sending them into a dragon's lair doesn't mean we need to kill somebody in that moment.
I'm beginning to think that, like, the Glaurung plan needs to be, like, a whole spin-off feature film. But anyway.
It's like, all right, here's our plot. We're going to...
Exactly. We're gonna put together this odd company of, like, people coming together for this improbable quest.
We're going to collect a treasure from all over Beleriand, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and then we're going to hide it in this.
We're going to build this whole flow chart of how we're going to trap the dragon.
So it's a bank heist, but you're not stealing from the bank. You're putting
it's the reverse bank heist. Yeah, exactly.
I need to hide this giant treasure inside the bank.
Exactly.
Then you let the dragon go in, and you lock the door. It's great.
Yeah. 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 Anyway, the idea I was going to suggest a little while back is that it's not really a silly idea. It's that we tell Nick that this is his job.
Mm-hmm.
We just assign Nick to solve the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. See, the thing is, when you make that Nick's job,
he might do it.
It doesn't make it not my job.
I see, right.
I'm going to object on his behalf to just solve this.
Right.
But if you're okay with there being some kind of dragon heist plan as part of the battle plan.
I can't see any way around it. Like, how do you... I mean, they're not stupid enough to not think about him. They're not going to just assume he's going to stay out of the battle. I don't think it's practical for them to try to hunt him down to kill him, though that could be in the cards if there's an opportunity, right? But again, that can't be plan A, right?
Right. Celegormen Fingon already did that when he was a young dragon.
Right.
And they've seen that what came out of Angband was not something they could do that
just
with.
Just hunt down. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and so again, you can't, and I don't even think like, the distraction plan alone right? Like, let's bring lots of treasure and hope he just snoozes on it and takes a long nap is a pretty weak plan
knock a
by itself.
You have to knock a bridge down and trap him in a...
Or cave in, you know, a tunnel entrance or something, right?
Like, you need to put the dragon in the bank vault and then lock the bank vault.
Yeah, exactly.
If you forget the step where you close the door to the bank vault, then this is not working.
Yeah, you need the really big box trap. I mean, I don't see any other way.
Okay.
I don't see any other way than that.
And it's a great, like, reverse Nargothrond, so...
Right. Especially with some of the Nargothrond connections, we can kind of make that work.
Yeah, no, I think that we can make it interesting and very plausible that it doesn't work. Because the dragon is going to show up at the battle. So the dragon is going to get out of the trap.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this was a long shot. So even if we don't kill any of the characters who are implementing it, it's still...
We could
kill characters doing this. It could completely fail altogether where they don't even trap the dragon. Like, they make the whole plan, but then the dragon doesn't go in the bank vault. And then they're stuck.
I kind of like a partial success of the plan. I mean, like, a delaying action, again, so that it looks like they're about to win and everything's working out, right? I mean, like, So Glaurung, I would be okay, for instance, with Glaurung arriving late to the party and leaving pretty quickly, right? If Glaurung's effect on the battle is not devastating. Because, again, we've done that, right? And, I feel like the dynamics need to be different. So... A story which goes, they trap him, it works, he gets out much faster than they hoped, right? So, like, it's not that the plan doesn't work, it works. He gets out, but he is still delayed, right? And then he gets to the battle, and right after he gets to the battle, he and Azaghal meet each other, and he ends up running away. And so it looks like, oh, everything's great, right? Everything panned out. We get the miraculous save.
I like that.
You like that?
Yeah.
I like that because the Near Knife is not about the dragon, and he's going to have his big season coming up.
Yeah.
There are Balrogs on the field. There's lots of orcs. There's Morgoth kind of behind the scenes. And we haven't talked about him at all. But, you know, there's other villains at play here.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, so if Glaurung kind of makes a cameo, you know, does some damage and then retreats from the field in the Near Knife, that's, I think that's enough for him to participate in it.
Agreed, yeah.
Or he's going to run havoc next to this.
Yeah, we don't need him. We don't really want him. We don't want to avoid him. And obviously we need him for Azaghal, but yeah. I think Glaurung ultimately having a minimal impact.
Balrogs.
Sorry?
Yeah, he'll undermine the Balrogs.
He'll undermine the Balrogs. Yeah, exactly.
Have him out there too.
Yeah. Exactly.
And one of the things that works very well in the Battle of the Pelennor Fields is how you have, like, it's going great. Oh, no, it looks like it's going terrible. Oh, it's going great. It looks like it's going terrible. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of turns in that battle.
Yeah.
And some of them are surprises, like the black ships. Oh, no. Surprise, it's Aragorn. Right? Like, there's a little bit of that.
Right. And we're doing that just in reverse. Right?
Right.
It's new allies. Yeah. Oh, great. Except, oh, no, they're betraying you.
So we're going to have, hopefully, in our wonderful planning of the Near Knife, which we will eventually do, mm-hmm. we can have ups, downs throughout this long
and Glaurung accomplishes one of those hills, right?
Yes.
Oh no, here comes Glaurung. Oh, hooray, he's gone. Thank you, Azaghal, right?
No, the dwarves left the battlefield because of Azaghal. Yeah, so, so that up and down thing is good. So if that's how we're using him in the battle, I think I'll be fine with that.
Yeah, and I certainly agree with Alana that we don't want him undermining the Balrogs, but even more than, like, or Uldor, frankly. I mean, like, Glaurung casts a really big shadow on the battlefield. And so if we want, we want things to be fine. I mean, even, like, you could imagine Glaurung coming and smashing the siege equipment, but we don't want him to do that. We want, you know, we want the betrayal to be involved in that. You know, that'd be fun. So anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So we are good mostly on the dragon. We just
good mostly on the dragon. Yeah.
Yeah.
Enough to move forward with. Okay. So thinking about Morgoth's position as a whole. First of all, checking in on Morgoth vis-a-vis where he is on his little journey towards the void, right? Morgoth had a bad time last season, right? He's sure just did. Had his Silmarillion. He's now got his lopsided crown, right? And he... So he's... It's now 2 seasons in a row in which he's been embarrassed by Fingolfin first and then by Beren and Luthien.
Yes.
Mostly Luthien second, right?
Beren's the one who cut the crown off.
But... True, true.
Yeah. But mostly Luthien.
But mostly Luthien, yeah. Okay, so anyway, what is his kind of mental, spiritual state, and what is his status? As far as, like, his Council of War, Glaurung is a free agent, essentially, and is not going to be reporting in regularly. Sauron's gone and not reporting in at all. All of Sauron's captains are dead. It's just Morgoth and Gothmog, right, playing, you know, two-handed poker there in Angband. I mean, there's Bulldog
there, but yeah,
he's second
much,
string,
much lower
anyway.
Down.
Yeah.
But
as far as like the bad guy head council that we had going on, Karkaroth's dead even, right? So like there's nobody of significant stature except for Gothmog, which means based on what we were depicting before with Sauron and Gothmog, Gothmog's basically running the show as far mm-hmm. as the military and everything is concerned, right? Gothmog now gets his own way, and his own way is Hulk smash most of the time, right?
Sure, sure. He is super loyal, though. So if Morgoth does do this, he will say, yes,
right.
sir. So
right.
There's not a danger of him going rogue or anything.
Right.
If anything, Morgoth kind of enjoyed playing his captains off each other and just watching them squabble. So
right.
His entertainment is gone, too.
Right. And so really the situation that Morgoth kind of finds himself in, this whole situation could lead to a kind of revival of Morgoth's independent activity, right? Because he was kind of backseat for the last mm-hmm. several seasons, right? As his, you know, Gothmog and Sauron were really kind of taking the lead in deciding what to do and fighting with each other. And as you said, he was kind of letting them do that. But now that it's just Gothmog, he has a henchman, right? Gothmog is his henchman, his heavy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is Gothmog going to make all the plans? I'm going to leave all the planning to Gothmog, right? He's not going to say, Gothmog, run the continent, right? So maybe this is a moment when Morgoth kind of takes the reins more firmly into his own hands, especially if he feels like he's lost face, right?
Right.
In the last two seasons.
That could be a motivation, because Morgoth's goal was always, I want to be in charge of everything. I want mm-hmm. everything to be mine, and I want everybody to do my will.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I want the world to be me, not just to... Yeah. Like, it was a very particular brand of power.
Yes.
And it didn't go well for him.
Right.
So he's been kind of mad about it for a long time. But at the same time, he's never been in any doubt that he's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Valar aren't interfering with him. And they're the only ones that he has any reason to think could defeat him.
Right.
I'm not saying he doesn't fear other people. Like, I'm not saying he wasn't afraid of Fingolfin or Luthien. But...
Yeah. No.
But he knows he's going to win. He knows that he'll win. So he's always had a great deal of confidence that Beleriand is going to fall to him one way or another, given enough time. And mm-hmm. it's not going to take that much time in his view of things.
And it's one of the reasons why he was content to let Gothmog and Sauron compete.
Yeah, like, just, you know, we'll get there.
Yeah.
But
We'll get there, and in the meantime, you know, we'll see which one of my lieutenants is the stronger, right? And sure. Yeah.
Right. But the failure of his strength and taking over everything is the, if I can't have it, no one can, nihilism, right?
Yeah.
Like, if Gothamog is Hulk smash, Morgoth is like, watch me. You know, right. He intends to destroy
yes.
completely everything.
Yes.
At some point, we said, how far is he in his path to the void? At some point, he doesn't want to win. He wants to destroy.
He wants to destroy. Yeah.
And I don't know where we want him to be at this moment.
It's one of the reasons why. So we had decided before that we were going to show, like, visible evidence that he is in decline because he's been distributing his own power into his underlings and into the orcs and everything else. So he's
into everything.
Into everything, yeah. The whole Morgoth's Ring situation, right, has been proceeding apace.
But we haven't shown it actually happen very much yet. Like, we showed Glaurung get souped up pretty fast. We showed Bulldog get zapped into being. We showed...
We at least implied Karkaroth. Bottomless
Dread
yeah.
whammy. We saw Karkaroth. Like, we're seeing things happen where it's clear that Morgoth just expends power and things happen, yeah. and we're showing a cost on him. But as far as the actual full scale of how much he can control, like, the fact that you can make your dog grow big is cool, I guess, but that is not what Morgoth's power is
right.
doing. We're not going to see what he's actually capable of until Hurin.
Right.
Like, the fact that he can do what he can do to Hurin's family is like, oh, you actually are running the world.
Right.
Like, from your throne in the north, you have actually been running Beleriand, and we didn't know about it. Like, there's that level of reveal coming.
Yes.
If we do it a certain way.
And the other thing that's obviously relevant from what you were just saying, Hurin, thinking about Hurin, right? We need to be actively setting up the conversation between Hurin and Morgoth, right?
Yeah.
So the things that Hurin is going to say to him need to be kind of made relevant by how he's... So it doesn't sound like Hurin's just talking, right?
Right.
When Hurin says what he says, it needs to be kind of sticking it to Morgoth, hitting him where it hurts, right?
Mm.
And that mm-hmm. the viewers themselves will have seen that Hurin's not wrong. Right.
Right.
Or at least we'll understand why he's as particularly angry as he is at Hurin's, at the
right.
kind of defiance that Hurin shows
right.
him.
Because it's a pretty extreme punishment.
Yes, it is.
And again, the spell of Bottomless Dread, the way he just smashed there, like, Morgoth reacting by, like, watch me overdo this ridiculously, is not out of character. Like, we've seen
And even
that.
The orcs were the same thing.
Yeah, like, yeah. over and over again, when Morgoth reacts, he reacts in anger and he overreacts. And it's a huge expense of power. But seeing him corrupt the world is not really something we've been seeing.
Yes.
So we haven't really seen what he's been using that power for or where it's been going.
Yes. Again, especially, as you say, like, the individual things, like making his dog grow big. But that's... And even the dragon. But that was ages ago, like 3 seasons ago, that mm-hmm. began. So... I'm thinking back again about what you were talking about, the distinction between wanting to win and wanting to destroy, right? And if we were to show him kind of walking that line, I think, I was just about to say that this doesn't seem like a bad time not to have him totally over that edge yet, necessarily, but to show him approaching that edge somehow, more overtly than we have before. But The problem is that doesn't seem to fit really well with the Hurin situation, right? He doesn't Yeah, go ahead.
Well, there's also the Turgon situation, which is related.
Right.
So one of the implications of the capture of Hurin is that Morgoth wants to find out where Gondolin is.
Right.
So that's on his mind, which strikes me as a I want to win rather than I want to destroy side of the ledger.
Yeah.
So he's still kind of wanting to defeat all the elven kingdoms at this point.
Yes.
As well.
Yes.
Right.
No.
That might be a measure of where he's at.
I agree.
Well,
and
especially with the having been shown up recently. Like, if the king of the elves is going to show up and wound you, it's like, well, first I have to kill all the elves and prove to them who's boss. And then I don't care what happens to the world.
Right.
Like, he does have that I want to win to make up for what Luthien did, what Fingolfin did.
Yeah, and I was going to add that even the Hurin, even the Children of Hurin situation, I mean, yeah, it's horrible. And yeah, in a sense, it's like a little bit of overkill. But it's not a blunt instrument, you know? He's not just smashing. Like, it's a pretty subtle thing.
That's where it shows that he's controlling the fate of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the distinction between what Sauron's been doing, what Gothmog's been doing, Morgoth's more than both of them.
Right.
And we haven't seen that.
And we haven't seen that.
We've shown him sitting on his chair, and he says he's putting his power into things, but what does that mean?
It's going to be important in the Turin story that we show that this is just an example.
Yes.
Actually.
Yeah.
This is just an illustration of the kind of thing he's doing.
Everywhere.
Right.
To everyone.
Yeah.
At all
because,
times.
Because really, that's what's at stake, right? I mean, Hurin says, I don't care because I know you're going to lose. And Morgoth is like, wait, what? You don't even understand the extent to which I have already won. Like, I am already winning, and there is nothing. I am going to teach you for the next few decades what me winning looks like, right? And I'm going to spell that out in your family. So he clearly is still invested in winning, and just like you said with Turgon as well. So he can't be too close to that edge yet. I think it's the opportunity for him to come out of the shadows.
Maybe he was getting close to that ledge, and then got showed up by Fingolfin and Luthien, and now he's more on the I'll win first, then I'll destroy then the world can get destroyed once I've conquered it.
I wonder, could he, this seems a little bit weird, but could he be kind of apathetic about the Nirnaeth? Like, he doesn't really care about, because the battle, I mean, I don't know. Like, he's not worried that he's going to be defeated.
What we seem to get from him is the understanding of, oh, they're going to try a thing, are they?
Right.
Well, let's see what they. Oh,
this could be fun.
They think they're going to do this. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I've got this. Just
right.
Have fun, guys. Go ahead and try.
You know what would be funny if we did. Go ahead. Yeah.
It works well also because we've made the Easterlings a Sauron thing, not a Morgoth thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's been Morgoth who's been cultivating the Easterlings to betray. That's Sauron's plan. So the apathy of Morgoth with respect to this battle, that supports that.
Right, and what Sauron is doing is not going to be unknown to Morgoth, right? Yeah. So
But he doesn't care. He's not involved in it.
No.
But it's also implied that the reason the Nirnaeth falls apart as badly as it does is because Morgoth anticipated it and countered it before they even got started.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the implication is very much there that he was not caught by surprise.
Yes.
And in fact, was very much ready for them.
He's swatting a fly. I mean, Morgoth is not going to get defeated until the Valar show up. So,
right.
You know.
That's what I meant when I said kind of apathetic. Like, he's not invested in the, I mean, he can still thwart it because it's like fun, right? And he does still want to beat them, but he's not I think his Turgon obsession doesn't start until after the battle, basically.
When Turgon survives and flips
away. When Turgon survives, and then he begins to get this kind of creepy feeling about Turgon, right? And we can show that developing, you know, next season. But prior to this, I mean, yes, they're presenting him, the elves are presenting him with the opportunity to smash them. And to do so in a kind of fun and satisfying way, right? Because they're sticking their necks out like this. So, okay, right? That'll be fun. But again, I don't feel like he's invested like that. This is what he's really sort of about. What is he about? What's he thinking about? He wants to win. He wants to. Again, even the Hurin situation, it seems to me, is about. He gets nettled by the confidence of Hurin's belief that the Valar are going to win and that Morgoth is going to lose, right? And that Morgoth is helpless, an escaped thrall, right? All the things that Hurin throws in his face. And so again, so he comes out and says for the first time in a long time, I'm going to pull back the curtain for you. I'm going to show you what I'm doing. I'm going to show you how deeply I have already won and how everything is already in my control. Right. But I think he's not there until Hurin's defiance. So for him, it's just the opportunity to smash them. Right. And he'll mostly leave Gothmog to do that. He'll plan some stuff. He'll make suggestions to Gothmog, you know, because again, Gothmog is perhaps a little too simple to be a devious counter planner necessarily. But
right, I think Gothmog definitely needs some guidance to be in the right place at the right time to do well. For instance, if the whole point of getting the elves to attack on the Western Front first, it wasn't Gothmog's idea to take a prisoner out and do that.
Yeah.
Gothmog's perfectly happy to do so, but he didn't think of that.
Yeah. Probably. No, exactly. That's just what Morgoth can show more almost negligently being like, here's what you do. Right. Yeah. No, I see. This is what they're doing. And so Gothmog can come in like, this is all a big issue. Right. And Morgoth just solves it, right? It's, you know, because maybe a first step to take this season is just to show how confident and in charge he is, right? He's confident and in charge, but still bothered by the fact that he's lost face, though. Don't want to lose sight of that element.
Yeah, because the anger and overreacting thing, that's like something bullies do because they're afraid insecure. That if they don't, they're going to, the insecurity thing. And I don't know, how much insecurity do we want to give Morgoth, who's the most powerful being in all of Arda?
Like, it's been weird convinced for of him. That from the very beginning.
Right. Know? It would be weird for him to be insecure in this situation. And yet he just had,
He's been bitten by flies. You know, I mean, that's how I see it. Like, he's been stung and he's angry at them and he wants to swat them. Yeah. Maybe so that's like not so much insecurity. That's just it's really ticked him off. That, like, he's got these wounds from Fingolfin. He's lost a Silmaril. These are serious ticking off things. He'll deal with the Silmaril at some point. I'm sure he's thinking he'll get it back.
Yeah. And in the meantime, it'll probably do good. I mean, for him, right?
That's right.
He'll let Doriath implode before he goes.
There's an upside.
So this is more like elephant and bees situation. Of elephants really don't like bees because who likes getting stung by bees?
Right.
So they'll avoid the sound of buzzing bees. They'll avoid.
Right.
Going near a hive, that kind of thing, because bees are unpleasant. Nobody
likes that, but they're not threatened exactly either.
But, yeah, I mean, bees aren't going to kill an elephant.
Right. No, and actually, so one of the points of Morgoth losing face, especially with Fingolfin, was how it impacted Sauron. Right? It changed Sauron's view of the situation. Yes. It doesn't mean that Morgoth has to feel insecure and sensitive about... Like, Morgoth doesn't have to feel that he's lost face.
Okay.
You see what I mean?
It's Sauron who feels that
it's
Morgoth
Sauron
has lost face.
Whose view of the situation has changed. Right.
That makes more sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I was just getting a little bit like, how far are we taking?
Yeah. No, exactly. So he's still... I mean, he's got to still be as full of himself as he ever was and as confident as he ever was, especially since, again, the play he's going to be making in the next season is with Húrin, I mean, is going to be look at what I can do and how in charge I am, right? And how hopeless it is to attempt. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. If you see with my eyes, you will see that I am the master of doom and nobody can do anything about it. Right.
Right.
So yes, Húrin will annoy him because of his confidence, his confident wrong belief, such that Morgoth will invest himself in teaching him the error of his beliefs.
Right. Morgoth is quite convinced at this point that the Valar aren't coming.
Yes.
But he still would be very much afraid of a reality in which the Valar do come. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not looking forward to that confrontation ever happening again.
Yes.
I would think. So, there is that dynamic of, I'm so powerful and I'm in charge and no one can do anything about me as long as they stay over there.
And it's a pretty good reason for him not going into battle himself.
Okay.
That is not drawing the attention of the Valar in that way.
Mm. If he personally goes and smashes all the elves, maybe the Valar will get mad at him.
Maybe the Valar will take sides against him, right? Like, basically, they seem content. They have seemed content on many occasions just to let things in Middle-earth fall out the way that they do. And so if he can be, like, puppet master of the whole thing rather than be... Because, I mean, yeah, that's the chance that they will come
in. He considers the Valar to be idle.
Yeah.
And not doing anything. And that's, of course, an opinion that the Noldor share.
Right. Just ask Fëanor. He'll tell you.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So that's probably the one point upon which Morgoth and the Noldor are in agreement. The Valar remain idle.
Yeah.
The disagreement would be on how long is that going to last. And in Hurin's case, he's thinking, well, you know, if we just get their attention...
Yep. Yes. Okay. So, I think seeing Morgoth kind of come out of his shell a little bit in this season would be a good thing then. Show that he is still in control. Show that he is, though again, as we say, not really invested necessarily. Like, he doesn't, he's not thinking... The elves aren't his enemies. He's not worried about them, as you say. I mean, they're his enemies, but just because they insist on being his enemies.
Right.
I mean,
he barely has to go out of his way. Trying to stop him from doing the things he is definitely going to do anyway.
Yes, exactly. I could imagine just a kind of dark amusement at learning of their plans to attack him. Like, that's cute. Right.
That fits.
Right. That's cute. And this might be kind of fun. Right. Yeah.
And the amusement can last right up until Húrin's defiance.
Yes. Yes. It's Húrin's defiance that wrecks the thing for him. And maybe he never gets angry until then. Right. And could be quite enjoying the Nirnaeth.
That would be our clue that all their hope might not be going well if Morgoth is just never worried.
Right.
All the ups and downs, at no point does Morgoth seem the least bit put out by anything that's happening.
Right.
And we're like, okay, does he just not know what's going on? Or
Yep.
And then we get to the point of, oh, it's because he knows it's not going to go their way.
Yeah. And of course, it's fun because Gothmog, for instance, will have no clue about Uldor.
Right. Right.
Because that's totally independent of anything. And so even he, even Gothmog,
could get worried.
Right. Could be like, well, shoot, what are we going to do? And then, you know, Morgoth is like, no, wait, this is the best part. Just wait. Right. It's going to get even better here. Right. And then, you know, because again, he's not going to be ignorant of what Sauron has been doing. Like he's
right.
He didn't plan it. Right. But he, you know,
but he knows it's coming. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, so that will set up when he basically tells her, and by the way, I rule the world.
Yeah.
And always have.
Yeah.
And
that's what I meant by setting that up, right? So if that's his frame, if we've shown that, right,
mm-hmm.
Then it makes Húrin's defiance more powerful, right?
Okay.
When Húrin voices something that even our viewers would sound shocking even to our viewers, right? Because they've all seen Morgoth being confidently in charge of the whole thing. So yeah. Okay. No, that's good. I think I like this position from Morgoth.
It just occurred to me at the end of the season, if the last thing we see is Húrin being dragged off alive, the viewers are going to go, like, what's season 8 going to be? Is this just a mopping up exercise, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Everything's mostly over. Surely nothing worse than this could possibly happen.
Enter Turin.
Enter Turin. Exactly. the one-man disc catastrophe. Okay, so we pretty much answered Gothmog. Bulldog. Didn't we have a theory for him? Didn't we have somebody who was going to kill him?
Right, so... we're able to kill him whenever we want now. We don't need him for anything in the future. So the idea was, why not kill him in the Nir Naeth? Nick had suggested having Húrin kill him during the battle at some point.
Yeah.
One, so that Húrin could establish what an awesome warrior he is. Like, why not? And to give him, you know, a named character to kill and all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
The thought, though, is if we do that, do we want to give any history between Bulldog and the House of Hador? And then people of Dor Lomond, because so far Bulldog's exploits have not involved that group of people in particular. So it would be a random part of the battle. Like the viewers have seen Bulldog.
Right. It would not be random in the sense that it would still be like a great accomplishment that would be accomplished in the witness, in the before the eyes of many who will remember it, right?
Right.
I'm thinking Bulldog is in charge of drawing out Gwyndor and company.
Okay.
He's the one who mutilates and kills Gwyllin.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
That seems like an obvious role for him. We don't want Gothmog. We don't want Balrog doing that, right? And if we don't have a Balrog doing it, we've got nobody else.
So why not Bulldog? Okay.
So why not Bulldog? And then in that first wave of the battle on the western side, the kind of the culmination of that can be Bulldog's death.
Bulldog versus Húrin. Okay.
Right. And I mean, obviously Gwyndor is going to be going for him, but he doesn't have to make it there. Right.
Right. Gwyndor should be not successful in the things that Gwyndor does at this point in time.
Yes, exactly.
So I'm okay with that.
So yeah, so I, that, that
all right. So that would give Bulldog a thing to have done before he gets killed. That would work.
Yeah, and a last important speaking role, because I mean, there's a bad guy with a speaking role, right?
Why not Bulldog?
In that scene? Which, other than Glaurung, we're not going to. I mean, there are a couple random orcs we'll overhear and stuff, but there aren't very many villains with speaking roles in the rest.
We
of the
We have killed most of them. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying not only that, but again, in the text, there are very few speaking roles left among the villains.
Right. And for the rest of them, we'll just say Balrogs or dragons moving forward, because we'll have multiples of both and they can all talk.
Yeah. So. I do like the suggestion, Ilana, you were making the suggestion earlier, that we name a Balrog or two in this season. first of all, that makes a lot of sense because, again, we've got nobody but Gothmog, really, in the councils, right? So that...
Who can Gothmog talk to?
Who can Gothmog...
Clearly, he needs another Balrog.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, the payoff of having a named Balrog is that, you know, one of the named Balrogs ends up in Moria, right? So, yeah. D-Rod Curry was just asking that exact question.
The other one has a boss fight with Glorfindel.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that Glorfindel isn't just killing random Balrog, which is still a big deal, right? You know, because we've decided on big Balrogs from the beginning, rather than many small Balrogs. Few big Balrogs has been our choice from the start. So killing any of them is going to be a big deal, even if they're not named. But it's kind of cooler if they're... if they're named, right? Because what we would be creating, say we have two named Balrogs, right? We have Gothmog and his two Lieutenant Balrogs, right? Well, then two of them are going to die in Gondolin, right? Gothmog and the Lieutenant are both going to die, and that just leaves the other Lieutenant, who is now the senior Balrog, who can be the one who survives and goes to Moria eventually.
So we'll have a story with him for the War of Wrath and how he escapes it and all that.
Well, I was going to say, because keep in mind, we're going to the War of Wrath, and everyone's going to be dead on the bad guy's side.
At this stage, no Balrogs have died, though, right? We've still got nine Balrogs?
Correct.
Is that right?
We're still... we have not lost any Balrogs yet. Right?
I think we had 10. So I'm wondering...
No, we couldn't have had 10, could we?
No, there was... Arian went off back to the good guys.
She was the 10th one, probably.
Counting Arian.
Sorry.
Okay, sure.
We had... Yeah. We had 20 Ionar who were following Melkor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And 10 of them were ice demons and 10 of them were fire demons. And the ice demons we took care of beginning of season one. Don't worry about those. So there were 10 fire demons. Arian's the 10th. That's what I was like.
Gotcha.
Okay. So nine. Yeah, nine Balrogs.
So there's nine Balrogs. So if we have Gothmog as lead Balrog and two Lieutenant Balrogs, and then we've got, the remaining Balrogs can get killed in the War of Wrath. That's fine. I mean, it might be that there's only the one left at the end that goes to Moria, or maybe another one goes somewhere else.
I believe we were planning to have another one just never be accounted for and never explained, and who knows whatever happened to it.
Because you never know when you might want another Balrog.
But the other reason I was thinking of named Balrogs plural was Fingon's death, which is
Gothmog.
With plural. Well, it's
plural
Balrogs.
But plural Balrogs, yes. Just like with Feanor, it's plural, yeah.
Yes.
So they would be involved in that particular fight.
No, I think it's... I'm kind of glad we didn't try to name Balrogs before, because we had... I mean, we already had lots. Of villains, we had lots. We had the advantage of have them be very disparate, right? So you weren't going to confuse Thorin Gwethil with Draugluin with Tevildo, right? We had the odd bunch before. To try to ask people to memorize the name of individual Balrogs seemed like a lot in that context. But they're dwindling. The bad guys are rapidly dwindling. And frankly, it's not even going to be that long before we're going to lose Gothmog and named Balrog number one, right? So pretty soon there will only be one named Balrog left to keep track of. And
Durin's Bane.
And him we'll keep, right? So anyway, yeah. But aside, we don't have to make a huge deal of it, right? But just giving Gothmog some Balrog interlocutors and having him mention their names is all I think we need for this season. And then one of the named ones can show up. There's got to be something distinctive about Balrogs if we're to remember to recognize, oh yeah, that's like that named one. So there has to be some kind of mark that we can recognize about them.
Their design has to be unique enough, that's all.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm open to what that is. Weapon, maybe. I don't know.
Coloration, because fire kind of is colored differently depending on heat.
Could potentially be coloration,
so
yeah.
Okay, so you want a blue hot Balrog and a red hot Balrog and a white hot Balrog. Sorry.
Yeah, something like that. Something. No, I don't know. But yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to point out that we're going to need some differentiation if we're going to suddenly name them. But the last question: circumstances are responsible for the deaths of Galdor and Emildir. At least one of them can die in the plague. That's easy, right?
Well, I think we wanted both those deaths to happen much earlier in the season than the plague.
Because we want them dead before Hurin and Morwen marry.
Basically, yeah.
Got you.
Or at least at the beginning of all that. So the idea would be that, the plague kills the Leviath, so that's much later.
Weren't we arranging some sort of battle situation?
Right. So Galdor originally dies in a skirmish fighting forces of Angband.
Yeah.
And that's how Hurin gets to be Lord of Dorlom at such a young age, because of his father's
untimely
death. And
we're
going
to want the opportunity to remind people, like, of Rogrin's existence, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. It's been ages since we've seen Rogrin.
Yeah,
so
Fingon's group is off-screen all of last season. Time to bring them all back.
And we can put them in, you know, at the council and stuff, but that's not the same. We don't want them just standing around listening to Fingon talk. So if there were some kind of military action, which could conveniently kill Galdor, and reintroduce some of those characters, that seems to be a prudent, an efficient kind of thing to do. Under what circumstances would Emildir be likely to die?
That was what was nice about the plague, because plague can kill anybody. But if the idea was that Morwen was experiencing the loss of the mentor and leader of her people roughly at the same time as her fiancé / husband, I don't know where they are in the relationship exactly.
We can't kill him in the same skirmish, can we? Can we have Emildir go too? I mean, that's really convenient, but
it is and seems unlikely that she would deliberately put herself in that circumstance. If it was some kind of ambush situation or she had been attempting to do something and then was attacked, I could see it. But for her to be like, yeah, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take my sword, which I carry, and run off and be part of this deliberate engagement with orcs.
It's pretty weak.
I can think of a couple of kind of less violent deaths. I mean, one would be that she gets injured and the injury gets infected and she dies of the infection. The other one is cancer. So they're not plague, you know, but some kind of medical death.
Okay, so she would have some kind of like wasting situation where she's clearly not well.
That's interesting in that we've never done that before. Yeah. It's just her time in that sense. And, right? She's just,
It's not old age. It's you know, but a cancer would cause wasting and so on. And so that there could be a recognition that her time was drawing near. And
You're right. And so that would give more of an opportunity of handing off to Morwen then.
Yeah.
And we could then couple, like, whereas Hurin would be dealing with the sudden loss of his father, the sudden and unexpected loss of his father and the premature ascension, right, to the throne. Morwen would have she would be grieving and coping while it's being handed off to her. So the situations wouldn't be identical, right?
Right, so it would be more of a parallel than a...
Right, right. They're both...
The same thing happened.
I mean, we could start the season with her already sick, you know what I mean? Like,
So it could progress.
I mean, I can't think of anything like that we could accomplish by her death. You know, any plot element that would be, you know, where her death would come in handy. You know what I mean? Apart from getting rid of her for Morwen to do her thing. So. And it is something, it is like an element of human mortality that we haven't dealt with, which could be interesting in itself, right? Even thinking about the context of Hurin and Huor's thing in Gondolin, right? Like, it's just kind of a reminder, like, look, you never know. It's not just old age, right? You never know, mm. right? Mm. Presumably, cancer isn't a thing that happens to elves, right? No. So, right. It's just like another aspect of mortality that, right. of the mortal situation, which, right.
it's yeah. The variety of illnesses, the portrayal of a chronic illness that is fatal is not something we've dealt with in some film, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
The closest the elves would have to that is the dying of grief situation.
Right, exactly. But
whatever yeah. Muriel did.
Muriel, the embodiment of the bad data point. Yes. Yeah, the poor example. Right,
meaning, like, so elves yeah, have seen yeah. that.
Exactly.
But not...
Yeah, and not, this is obviously
wasting,
so different.
A wasting pain. It's painful and it's wasting, and she's going to be in a lot of pain at the end.
Yeah,
so right. And not able to do what she formerly could, and mm-hmm. medicine doesn't help, and yeah, that kind yeah. of thing. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And even the elves presumably would not be able to. I mean, yeah, would not be able to help. Right. Be no question of elvish medicine that could solve this.
That's the advantage of it not being an infection in retrospect.
Right, yeah. right. Which yeah. presumably the elves could handle. Yes. Yeah, but like brain tumor, probably less so. Right.
Yeah, I don't know how they would even begin to diagnose that.
Exactly. Yeah, me neither. So. Nor, since it's not a thing that they deal with, would they have any experience or idea of what
remedy
to do.
For it, or yeah. Yeah.
Does anyone have a suggestion for what kind of cancer? I just threw out brain tumor, like, off the top of my head, so to speak. But is there, I mean, any, like...
I don't think we need to specify.
No, I'm just thinking, like, it could
certain
matter.
Certain symptoms are more likely with certain things than others. I know, like, you said painful, and immediately I was thinking about bone cancer and how you would eventually lose the ability to walk, really. Yeah. Without yeah. being in extreme
again,
pain.
It's not something yeah. we have to talk about, but it might be good for us to have a clear idea so that we know how to depict her symptoms, is what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Right, exactly. I would shy away from brain tumor because that tends to alter people's personality.
True. And that would be all
not always, too. Obviously. Yeah.
Breast cancer would be another one.
And I was thinking of that too.
As a common one, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Something like bone cancer. Is I like the sort of more kind of like systemic sense of that, you know. Anyway, yeah. Okay. As I said, it's not crucial, and again, it's not like we're gonna do a whole, you know, a whole medical episode on this.
Because yeah, they won't know necessarily what's
they
wrong.
They won't know, exactly. So they won't even know how to
ill,
talk about
and
it.
She's ailing and she's not getting better, and
yeah, but like I said, if
it's
we
not catching, but
if we make up our mind so that we know how to depict yeah. it, it would probably be smart.
Sure.
So that we don't end up just being clumsily
randomly
vague.
Sick.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. But yeah, D. Roy Curry was suggesting maybe like a blood cancer. Yeah, I was kind of
like lymphoma or something.
Lymphoma. Yeah, I was kind of thinking about that too. Yeah, yeah.
Something systemic that would
exactly something would systemic count. So that it's not just yeah. like there is a palpable tumor growing in a part of her body, but yeah,
that's yeah why I was leaning more bone cancer as well. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, so something a little more pervasive and hard to pinpoint the problem
and progressively debilitating. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Okay. Well, that has been a depressing conversation, which is right in line with the near ninth Arnoidiad season, right? We're trying to find new ways to bring horrible and depressing death to our characters this season. That's, yeah, yeah.
Poor Emildir.
Poor Emildir, mm. Yeah. But I think that that's, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I think that that's, I can't, again, saying it, you know, we haven't dealt with that aspect of mortality yet, and I can't think of a better time. I mean, like, there's not going to be a, I can't imagine a time in the, I mean, I can imagine it could possibly come up, but I can't imagine there's going to be a time where we're going to like want to be dealing with this. And if we do, we can always deal with it again. It's not like it's going to be a central theme. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be pretty ancillary to what's going on in the main season on the whole. But okay. All right. All right. Lots of very interesting decisions today. And that leads us towards our outline next time. We should, in theory, be ready. Now we have all of the stuff on the table.
All the pieces are there. We just got to figure out how to put them together. All the pieces are there.
Exactly. So we start to work the jigsaw puzzle next time and come up with the basic outline, 13 episodes. So that'll be next time. And next time is scheduled to be Thursday, February 15th, which is right before Sunshine Moot, but I will still be here. So I'm not leaving till Friday. So that should be fine. All right. So Thursday, February 15th, we will do the outline. Thanks very much. Thanks, Alana, for joining us at the sort of spontaneously at the last second. Great to have you.
Great fun. Great to play hooky.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. I know it's in Australia, it's the middle of the workday, right? But hey, it's summertime, right?
Luckily, I have it's summertime and I have a flexible work schedule.
Yeah, exactly.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, no, that was great. And Marie, thanks as always. And we will see you again in a couple of weeks. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.